This is Tim Arson, the arsonist, El Perro Maniaco. You're listening to The Sound Off with the Sound Monster. Oh, I screwed it up. The Solo Monster. This is Tim Arson, the arsonist, a.k.a. El Perro Maniaco, a.k.a. your daughter's crush. No, I'll do it one more time. I'm sorry. This is Tim Arson, a.k.a. El Perro Maniaco, a.k.a. the arsonist, and you're listening to The Sound Off with the Solo Monster. And there's also another monster. Brains.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 363 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, January 11, 2015. I am the Solo Monster. It was on this day over 20 years ago that Monday Night Raw was born. 20 years on the air. See, Raw's like that old person that just doesn't give a fuck. They don't even try anymore. If you watched that show last Monday, that's pretty obvious. Senility has set in. Poor Monday Night Raw has gone senile in its old age. It's very sad. And for the few people who say that I never have anything positive to say, first of all, you clearly don't pay attention to this show. But second of all, I have a lot of positive things to say this week, just not about Raw. And I'm not alone either. WWE put up a poll on their Facebook page as soon as Raw ended, asking the fans whether they liked the show or not. Yeah, it reminded me of that scene from Die Hard 3 where Gruber sends McClane to Harlem with a giant sign around his neck that says, "I hate," followed by the N-word. In other words, you know it won't end well. I think something like 16,000 people voted no. They did not like that show. Only 2,000 people said yes. It was completely lopsided. And still, you know, you'll have people who argue, well, this poll was conducted on the internet. So obviously it was the internet wrestling fans who voted in that poll. Let me tell you something. Let me ask those people something. Have you seen the WWE Facebook page? Have you seen some of the verified superstar pages that they have on Facebook? Have you seen John Cena's Facebook page, for example? Do you see the people that leave comments on these pages? These are not what you would call internet wrestling fans. These are casual fans, some of whom still think wrestling is real, who are on these Facebook pages. They also voted in this poll. What does that tell you? And if you think that maybe, you know, it'll be a wake-up call for WWE, keep dreaming. They'll just chalk it up to the authority having great heat. See, it's working. They're heels. Ignoring the 5,000 other things that are wrong with their show. I was at the Impact tapings on Friday night at the Manhattan Center. They taped two shows, one of which was their lockdown show that will air on TV next month. And by now, I'm sure you've all heard, you've all seen the video, which was shot by the guy, by the way, by the name of Bill, who was sitting right next to me with his kid. TMZ picked up the video. It's been all over the place of Jeff Hardy's fall from the cage. Not the top of the cage. What happened is he got crotched on the cage door. He got waffled upside the head by a chain and then fell, did not put his arms out to protect himself at all, and took a very nasty landing, a bad bump, onto the steel steps. Since the cage was set up, they had the steel steps right there in front, and I don't think he was supposed to fall on the steps, and he did head first and knocked himself out cold. So it was a really nasty fall. I mean, we all knew it as soon as it happened. I'll talk more about that and get into the Impact spoiler stuff on those shows later on, so you'll want to stick around for that. It was, I can tell you right now, it was probably the sickest live bump that I've ever seen. I had a front row seat for it, and it was not fun, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on. I do want to just take a few moments here to talk about something more serious. You heard the sounds at the beginning of the podcast of one Tim Arson, who was wrestling on the independent scene for many years as the arsonist Tim Arson. He spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico. Nickname there was El Perro Maniaco. He was also the ECW Zombie. I had the pleasure of interviewing Tim on the Sound Off, my very first interview back on Sound Off, episode 129. For those of you who may have missed it, I took the entire interview itself and added it on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolemonster, as a Sound Off retro video. So if you want to go back there, it's about 40 minutes long. It's a lot of fun. It's probably one of the most fun interviews I've done. I've done a whole bunch. And Tim was very gracious in my dealings with him. I didn't know him very well. I kind of ended up connecting with him through a mutual friend who's on the, you know, independent wrestling scene. And then from there, we would keep in touch every now and then. I didn't have the chance to bring him back on the show, which is a shame because I did think about it a couple different times as Halloween approached over the years. I always thought it was kind of cool and it made sense given the whole zombie thing to tie him into Halloween in some way. And never did get him back on the show, but we would keep in touch every now and then. And was very, very sad to find out that he had passed away this week. Only 38 years old, you know, just ridiculously young. They found him, he was in his bed. And he leaves behind a 5-year-old son that I know he was crazy about. I think most people who even loosely knew Tim, if you were friendly with him on Facebook, he was constantly posting photos of himself and his son. He would put videos up every now and then with his son. He just adored that kid. And just very sad. I mean, I don't really know what else to say. I was completely bummed out when I heard the news. I was hoping it wasn't true. It was broken on a Puerto Rican wrestling Facebook page. Again, he spent a number of years in Puerto Rico, had a lot more success there than he did even here. He was a multiple time, he was a world champion down there, a tag team champion. And he talks a lot about his experiences in Puerto Rico on the in the interview that we did, which was back in 2010, and how it really helped him out a lot, and he benefited a great deal from learning the style, and how you really benefit from learning a variety of different styles, which is kind of a lost art now, because you got a lot of guys that are down there in the developmental center, the performance center, and they—I mean—they're stockpiled now with indie talent in NXT. But a lot of those guys that everybody is just raving about, like Neville and Zayn and Owens and Finn Balor and Hideo Itami, you know, these are not rookies. You know, these are guys that cut their teeth on wrestling in Japan or on the independent scene or in Canada and Europe, all over the world, Mexico. And they know a variety of different styles. And these are guys, in a lot of cases, who had 10, 12, 13 years of experience before they ever came to NXT. And now, they're on the same level as a guy like a CJ Parker, you know, or an Enzo Amore. So, things are just very different now. And I think those guys, you know, like the Enzo Amores and guys like that, you know, they just kind of go to WWE and they learn one style. And you know, one thing that a lot of us complained about, and Tim complained about it too in the interview that we did, and this was almost 5 years ago that we did this interview, and if anything, I think it's even worse today, is that you don't learn new styles. It's actually kind of frowned upon in WWE. And if you do know different styles, they want to reprogram you to do their style of wrestling. And that's their prerogative, I guess. But it was a really enlightening interview to hear from somebody who's kind of been in the trenches before and, you know, very frustrated that he didn't get that shot with WWE that he was hoping to. He was hoping there would be a part two beyond the zombie stuff that he did years ago. And it's just very sad that he never really had a chance for a part two. And then to hear that this happened, it sucks. It really sucks. So thoughts are with his family. And especially his son, it's just terrible. It's, you know, 5 years old, and for that to happen to your dad, I mean, it just is awful. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and just say rest in peace, Tim. You know, he was a good man. He was just a laid-back guy, really fun to interact with. And I only wish I had more opportunities to chat with him and maybe even hang out with the guy. Seemed like a fun dude. And again, thoughts are with his family and friends right now. You can check out that interview. Again, it's up on the YouTube channel. Give it a listen. I think you might like it. And there's even some good nuggets of information in there if you're the kind of person who maybe might want to get into the wrestling business or if you are an independent wrestler. As somebody who, you know, yes, he never made it big on the WWE stage, but, you know, he had a pretty good career for himself as a guy on the independent scene. I think there's some valuable information in there. So check it out. I think it's worth your time. On a happier note, I had a nice phone conversation with Bruce Hart this week, one of the many sons of Stu Hart. I'll be appearing on his podcast, Heartbeat Radio, coming up on January 22nd. I'll mention it again before it happens. This was really just meant to be a quick call to just go over a few things, and we ended up talking for almost 40 minutes. Some fun tales he shared of being brought in to referee the Bret Hart-Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania 26. Among other things, he's a very opinionated guy, so I'm sure we'll get along just fine. Maybe he'll share some of those stories on the show when I'm on, we'll see. So that should be a lot of fun. Thank you for making The Sound Off a top 5 sports podcast on Stitcher Radio last week and cracking the top 100 shows on all of Stitcher. And there are a lot of shows, thousands of shows on Stitcher, and we made the top 100. Congrats also to the Don Tony and Kevin Castle show and Wrestling Soup for making the list as well. In fact, 4 of the top 5 spots on the sports chart were taken up by wrestling podcasts. So, fuck yeah! Wrestling. Keep streaming us on Stitcher. Even if that's not the primary way you listen to this podcast, maybe you get it in iTunes or whatever, direct download. Streaming just a few minutes here and there of The Sound Off will help us out a lot. And you can leave a review for the podcast on there as well. So again, big thank you to everybody who made that possible. Audible, got to mention Audible here. Doing real well. People still signing up using our URL. Use it. audibletrial.com/solomonster. We'll get you 30 days free of the Audible service. You can play around with it, check it out. Doesn't cost you a penny, and you get a free audio book at no cost to you. Even if you don't stick with the trial, if the 30 days are up and you're not quite sure, I don't know if I want to stick with it, you get to keep that audio book no matter what. It belongs to you. It's like back when you were in school. You would write your name on the inside of the book. You've branded it. It's yours. It belongs to you. And there's a ton of different books. Brock Lesnar's book would be a recommendation of mine this week. It's called Death Clutch. I read the book about a year or two ago, maybe, in hardcover. It's an easy read. I'm sure it's an even easier read, and you know you can get it for free in audio form. So check it out. They have that on there. A bunch of other books. audibletrial.com/solomonster. You just punch in that URL. It takes you to the main page. But once you do that, it kind of registers our code. And then from there, if you actually go through the sign-up process, we get a little kickback of something. It helps out the podcast, and we all win. So definitely use our URL and help us out in that way. Also, you can make a PayPal donation. PayPal donations are accepted on our website, thesolomonster.com. You'll see the donation box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Got to give a shout-out to Russell. Thank you, brother. Damn straight Michael Dorsey, who also bought 2 shirts from our store as well. That's dedication right there. So thank you, my friend. Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, Hytham the Equalizer, Al Nawasser, James Hollywood Henderson, Trevon Cannonball Clark, the Australian Ass Kicker, still one of my favorite names, Anthony Patty, Man Up Manny Alcantara, the Angel of Danger, Stephanie Brown, Patrick Goodfeelin' Whelan, Craig Pitbull Brown, the Swashbuckler, Stephen Wrangle, and Wilson, oh my God, Okendo. Thank you to everybody who made a donation. Again, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. And last but not least, before we move on here, prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff is our URL for our Pro Wrestling Tees store. Doing real well. We've got some ideas for a couple new designs that hopefully will be going up in the next several weeks. But we got 11 different shirts up right now. You can pick up your shirt. Tweet me your photos wearing your shirt, and I will be happy to retweet them for all to see. I want to see all your photos. You guys have been sending them in. They've been awesome. And I know some of you are not, so be sure to send those in to me. Also, I want to take an informal poll here and ask you guys, would you buy a Sound Off baseball cap? Because we may be able to offer them. It'd be a black hat, probably, just with the Sound Off logo on it, something that would look good embroidered on a black hat. Would you buy a hat? Are you a hat guy or girl? Let me know, and we may be able to get that up in the store soon, too. So prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. I want to lead off here on a happy note, and nothing makes me happier than thinking back to last weekend's Wrestle Kingdom 9 pay-per-view, presented by New Japan Pro Wrestling, brought to us by Jeff Jarrett's Global Force Wrestling. And I still don't know too much about Global Force Wrestling or what the hell it is and what it's going to end up being. All I know is it was because of GFW that I was able to watch this on pay-per-view for the very first time. So I say thank you. Thank you to Jeff Jarrett and GFW because I had a blast. It was a 4-hour show. It did not feel like 4 hours. You know, when it was over, it was like, wow. That was an easy watch, and I actually was kind of hoping for more. The complete opposite of how I feel after 3 hours of Raw every single Monday. It's amazing how that works. But I found myself during this pay-per-view saying, okay, this is my favorite match. And then it's like, no, wait, this is my favorite match. No, wait, this is my favorite match. For real this time, I'm serious. That was the pattern all night long once we got deeper into the card. And it was just an amazingly fun wrestling experience. And as I joked on Twitter, you know, about halfway through the show, I said, you know, I just don't get it. Why are the announcers not cracking jokes? Why are they not telling me what's trending on Twitter? Why are they not plugging the official hashtag for Wrestle Kingdom 9? It just didn't feel like a wrestling show to me. Where were all the plugs? Where were all the plugs for New Japan World? I just didn't understand that. That must be a foreign concept now to me as a wrestling fan. It was actually refreshing. It was refreshing to have announcers that paid attention to the show. I know, what a novel concept. Jim Ross, that was, you know, one of the things I was most looking forward to, was listening to JR back as a play-by-play announcer, not a color guy, not a guy that would contribute a little bit here and there. He was back in the role that he was born to do, and he hasn't really done it for a number of years, and I thought Jim Ross was excellent on this show. And also, credit where credit is due, I thought Matt Stryker was very good as well. JR, you know, he was a little slow going, I think, at the beginning. It took a little while for him to really get into the show. And in his defense, I mean, the show opened with just nonstop action and lots of multiple-man matches and six-man and eight-man tags with a lot of guys that he had never seen before, you know, and that he had never been really familiarized with. So it was just one thing after another after another. But by the time they got about midway into the show, into the singles matches, the Minoru Suzuki, Kazushi Sakuraba match, and then the Ishii match with Makabe, and those, you know, like smash mouth in your face matches, that was when I found Jim Ross was in his element. That was where he really excelled, and I think having him on that show added a lot to it. I also loved his little subtle digs at WWE and TNA throughout the night. I especially liked how he put over their version of the Intercontinental title during the Nakamura match, and he said, you know, why would you want to have a title that doesn't have the credibility of the other titles in your company? It was like, it was something to that effect. And I might be mangling that a little bit, but you get the point. And he's right. You know, for everyone who doesn't understand what the hell I'm talking about when I rant about the importance of titles and what a difference it makes, just watch the two main events on this show. I implore you, find a way to watch the two main events on this show. I don't care if you've never seen a second of New Japan wrestling, if you don't care about Japanese wrestling, if you're trapped in the WWE bubble, okay, burst the bubble, step on outside for just a second and watch these two main events, and you'll see what I'm talking about. I mean, it's night and day. It's not just the matches themselves, it's the presentation of the matches. So try to find it with English commentary if you can. It's just an amazing difference when you compare how title matches are presented in WWE and even TNA to a large extent, and how they're presented on this show and in a company like New Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, that's how it used to be. That's how it should be. There's no reason why things shouldn't be that way now. You can have all the silly comedy, you can have all your sports entertainment bullshit. It doesn't mean that your championships have to be diminished, you know, into practically nothing, which is how things are today. And so that was really refreshing. And again, I'm not even going to really rant about it anymore. I mean, I've said my piece on titles. But the next time some idiot tries to debate me on whether or not the titles are really all that important in wrestling or should be important in wrestling, I'm just going to track down a DVD of this show and beat them over the head with it. The only issues I had with Matt Stryker, again, I thought he was very good on this show, but there were two times where I just cringed. He made a comment, it was either in the Suzuki match or the Ishii match, that matches like this illustrate that wrestling isn't fake, or something to that effect. Why would you make a comment like that during a wrestling show? I mean, come on. You don't hear an actor in the middle of a movie, or in the middle of you know, act two of a Broadway play, talking about how it's not real, you know, and breaking down the fourth wall. I don't want to hear stuff like that during a wrestling show. I also didn't like him marking out again on commentary. I'm marking out, you know, fine. Don't tell us. You know, mark out quietly. It's like when I go to shows sometimes, like I go to a lot of shows. And sometimes there'll be something that happens and I'm marking out. But I'm marking out on the inside. You know, I'm not there like waving my hands around and jumping up and down and acting like, acting like a crazy person. That's just my approach to it. You're on commentary. You know what I mean? Like your job, you're sitting there, you're announcing on the show. I don't want to hear the announcers talking about how they're marking out. He did that. I mean, that's what got him into trouble at the Rumble all those years ago when Booker T came out, if you remember that whole thing. And he was like, I'm marking out, bro. And I could practically like feel the other announcers sitting next to him, like giving him the evil eye. And it was after that he got taken off commentary. They made him a backstage interviewer. Eventually he was gone. I mean, that's all it takes sometimes is one bad moment. And he didn't mean anything bad by it. I mean, the guy, he was, you know, he's a fan. I mean, I think with Stryker, the thing to me is I think sometimes he's too overenthusiastic for his own good. I mean, that's just my opinion. And we got a little bit of that on this show. You know, and again, I can only imagine what JR was thinking when he hears that. He did shut down Stryker at one point when Stryker used the word swerve. I forgot what he was talking about. It might have been Yujiro joining the Bullet Club. I mean, I forgot what it was, but he used the term swerve. And JR shut that shit down pretty quick. He was having none of that. Other than those things, I thought Stryker was fine. I thought he was very knowledgeable about the New Japan product. I think he complimented JR very well. He talked a lot more than JR did, but it wasn't overwhelmingly like, shut up, you're taking over the show kind of thing. I thought that they made a pretty good team. But like I said, Stryker sometimes is just way too overenthusiastic for his own good. You know, maybe that's not a bad thing. At least somebody sounds enthusiastic about their job on commentary these days. Some other notes I was tweeting out during the show. I loved all the photographers at ringside. I had forgotten that that's kind of how it used to be at all the like the WWE shows, at least for like the big pay-per-views. You would have, you know, local photographers, Japanese photographers, back when the magazines were a lot more prevalent, magazines now. I mean, the wrestling magazine business now is, it's not dead, but it's basically on life support. I mean, that's just the way it is in the magazine industry in general. I mean, everything is going digital and online. So you used to see a lot more of that back in the day. And then when WWE went HD in 2008, I want to say, and I interviewed George Napolitano, maybe, you know, one of the most prolific wrestling photographers that there's ever been. And he was instrumental in the careers of a lot of big-name guys back in the day because that's how important your pictures being in a magazine or being on a magazine cover like Pro Wrestling Illustrated back in the day would mean. Even for a guy like Triple H, you know, and George is somebody who was taking photos of a young Triple H when Killer Kowalski was first breaking him in. And, you know, you could trace his first big break in WCW back to pictures that George took. So I interviewed George on the Sound Off way back when, episode 182. And I think we actually talked about this on the show. When they went HD, they took the photographers away from ringside on the televised events and they kind of put them in a pit area off camera. And George actually told me something that surprised me. He actually likes that better because now he doesn't have to kind of compete for space around ringside with other photographers. But they just kind of take everybody now and they put them in this pit off camera. You don't see them. I think on the house show sometimes they'll let the photographers be at ringside because it's not on TV. But that's a Kevin Dunn thing. I mean, I guess he just didn't think it looked, you know, HD friendly. You know my thoughts on Kevin Dunn. I think it makes the show seem more important when there's a whole bunch of people shooting it at ringside. Again, it's a minor thing, but something I noticed that jumped out at me. I've also decided in watching the Minoru Suzuki fight with Sakuraba that I would pay money, good money, to see John Cena wrestle Minoru Suzuki, preferably a no DQ match. Jim Ross loved Nakamura. Shinsuke Nakamura is his favorite wrestler. Matt Stryker, I think, said the same thing. Nakamura is his favorite wrestler in the entire world. That's pretty high praise, especially coming from JR. He also mentioned that Nakamura idolized Freddie Mercury of Queen and Michael Jackson, which no doubt made Webmaster Mike's heart flutter when he heard that. Expect lots of Nakamura stories now on SEScoops.com. But JR put this guy over like a god among men. I mean, what a contrast to what we saw 24 hours later with JBL absolutely burying the Ascension on commentary, just 6 feet under. And he's supposed to be the closest thing that they have to a traditional heel announcer in WWE. I assume, you know, he was told to do it, but still. Whoever made that call needs to have their head examined. But I mean, wow, what a difference to go from that to that in terms of the commentary. They couldn't put Nakamura over more if they tried. And he is awesome. I mean, he probably is, in all honesty. I mean, it's a subjective thing, but Nakamura, you could certainly argue, is the best wrestler in the world right now as a package. I mean, not just his in-ring ability, which is awesome. He puts on very entertaining matches, but his whole character, his style, like, he's a guy who you could say, okay, this guy is the greatest thing in Japanese pro wrestling, but he would never work in America, because in America you've got to have a gimmick and you've got to sports entertain in WWE. Believe me, this guy could go to WWE. I don't know how good his English is. I think he does know a little bit of English, so that might be a strike against him. But this guy could go to WWE tomorrow, and if they let him be himself, which they wouldn't, but if they did, he would get over. Like, he is awesome. He's just such a weird, unique, fun, entertaining guy to watch. And his match with Kota Ibushi was my favorite match of the night. Probably match of the year. I mean, not probably. It is the match of the year so far, but it may still win match of the year even when 2015 is over, which is still a ways away. That's how good that match was. It was just fucking great. I loved watching that match. And the main event, no slouch, you know. You had Tanahashi and Okada, who have had, I think, five or six other battles prior to this. And they went in there, had a main event that was excellent. And to see Tanahashi doing a high fly flow, which is basically a frog splash, from the top rope, out of the ring, over the barricade, onto Okada, who was on the outside, was pretty amazing. You know, Tanahashi is no rookie. He's 37 years old. His body is beaten to shit. He's got a bad neck. He's got a bad back. And there he is, up there, flying like a bird, you know, and he nailed it. So these guys went out there. They had a great match. My favorite part of the match, though, was Okada and the dropkick. I've heard a lot of people talk about this, and Jim Ross has talked about this as well. Jim Ross, the entire match, kept talking about how Okada has maybe the best dropkick in all of pro wrestling. The height that he gets on it, the way he nails it, he is a special guy when it comes to his dropkick. So he talks about this dropkick the whole match. And Okada doesn't do it. I think usually he does like two or three drop kicks in a match. No drop kick. And the match went about 30 minutes. So the match is going on and on and on. And finally, in the final 2 minutes of the match, he nails the drop kick out of nowhere on Tanahashi. And you've never seen a single drop kick get this kind of reaction before. And JR, I mean, he sold this drop kick on commentary like Austin had just hit the stunner on The Rock at WrestleMania. That was one of my favorite moments of the entire night. The Nakamura match was my favorite match. That was probably my favorite moment. Just when he hit that fucking dropkick in the final 2 minutes of the match, and then we got the finish about a minute or two later, and Tanahashi won. It was great. And what I also loved was when the match was over, Okada's going to the back. He's got, is it Jado or Gato that comes out to the ring with him? I always forget. But anyway, he's walking to the back, and Okada is just bawling his eyes out. He's crying because he lost this match. He lost the match. He failed. He didn't win the championship from Tanahashi. He is just beside himself with emotion, bawling his eyes out. Tanahashi gets on the top rope. He's kind of looking down the aisle. He's yelling Okada's name. Hey, Okada, you know, turn around. And he said something in Japanese. Some of you guys wanted to know what the translation was. The literal translation of what Tanahashi said to Okada is, "How do you feel right now? I'll tell you one thing, so listen closely. IWGP is still so far away from you." Matt Stryker's translation of it was similar. He said that Tanahashi basically said, "I'm still the man, and you've got a long way to go." That was basically what he said to him. So, what a prick. But you know, I've never seen Okada cry before. I don't know, maybe he's cried after a match. That's the first time I ever saw that. And I didn't watch that and think, God, what a pussy. I watched that and I thought, God, you know, this guy really cares. He really came. I mean, he didn't win the title, and so now he's just, you know, a ball of tears. And it's such a foreign thing to see when you watch mostly WWE week in and week out, and you see guys like John Cena, and you see guys like Sheamus, okay? Remember when Sheamus lost the World Heavyweight title to the Big Show on that pay-per-view back in, it was like a No Mercy show, whatever the hell it was, Hell in a Cell, I think, a few years ago. They actually had a really good match, and Big Show knocked him out, and Sheamus comes out on Raw. The first thing he does, he's out there, he's smiling. Got a big fat smile on his face. Lost the world title the night before. Got knocked out, but he's in a great mood. And I guess in WWE, why wouldn't you be? Because you can lose your championship. You know you're going to get a fucking rematch. But there he is. He's out there smiling. How many times have we seen that with John Cena? 15-time champion. Hey, I'd smile too, because I know I'm just going to get the belt back. So who cares? He comes out there the night after. Usually he's got a smile on his face, or he's got a smirk. And the fans are watching that. You know what I mean? Like, you're trying to convey this to the fans, whatever emotion it is. And you're just telling people that it doesn't matter. You know, these matches don't matter. And New Japan has a different approach to it. I think it's the right approach. I like that. I like that aspect of it. It just made it feel that much more important. So I really did. I love the show a lot. I hope it did well enough for them to bring it back, maybe do it a few times each year. I think if it did well enough, I would think the next show they would do would probably be, they've got a big show coming up in April, I think right after WrestleMania. But it depends on how the show did. I don't know what the magic number is. I would think if the show did at least 10,000 buys on traditional pay-per-view, they would do it again. If it's any less than that, probably not. Probably not. So we'll wait and see what the numbers are. I really do. I hope it did well enough, though, because if they did, I would gladly pay my $34.95 to watch this show again. It was awesome. There was a WWE announcing shakeup this week. The new announced team, the new permanent announced team from Monday Night Raw, will be Michael Cole, JBL, and Booker T, who filled in for Jerry Lawler this past Monday night. Lawler was, I think, just out of the hospital. He had the bout of diverticulitis, so Booker filled in for him. Apparently, Booker is going to permanently fill in for him now. And the new SmackDown announced team, again, SmackDown moves to Thursdays this week. For those of you SmackDown fans out there, the few of you that do exist, SmackDown will now be on Thursdays at 8 p.m. The new SmackDown crew will be Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and Byron Saxton. I was amused. In WWE's official press release, they had this line in there. They said, Michael Cole has been the voice of WWE for more than 15 years, calling all of the action on Raw, SmackDown, and pay-per-view events. Really? Michael Cole was the voice of the company 15 years ago? I didn't know that. 15 years ago, unless he gained a few pounds and a southern accent, I could have sworn that it was somebody else I was listening to on the main shows all those years ago. Maybe my mind is going. I'm happy that Jerry Lawler is off Raw. Here's the thing with Jerry Lawler. Okay, let me just say this. You know how I feel about Jerry Lawler's commentary for years now. Jerry Lawler is no good anymore on commentary. At least the kind of commentary they have him doing. It's always hard to know how much of that is him, how much of that is what they ask of him. But whatever he's doing, it's not working. And he's been bad for a while. That does not mean that I hate Jerry Lawler. In fact, just the opposite is true. I like Jerry Lawler. You know, and when he had his heart attack all those years ago, he wasn't very good then on commentary either, but when he had the heart attack, I was hoping, you know, he would pull through and that he would have a comeback. And, you know, it's not like I'm wishing ill on the man. I just have no interest in listening to him on my television on Monday nights. But Jerry Lawler is one of the all-time greats. You know, Jerry Lawler is still to this day one of the best talkers in pro wrestling, just not on commentary. But if he's in an angle, you put a microphone in his hand. I mean, the guy had an independent match a few months ago with Kevin Steen before he reported to NXT. They had a Jerry Lawler-Kevin Steen match on an indie show. And they both cut promos on each other, and Jerry Lawler's promo on Kevin Steen was actually very good. I know, what a newsflash. Jerry Lawler is a good promo. He is, still, to this day, 60-something years old. So Jerry Lawler's place in wrestling cannot be denied. I like Jerry Lawler, the wrestler. I like Jerry Lawler, the promo. As an announcer, he is so far past his expiration date. It's like you open up that container of milk and it's curdled and it's like fucking clumps. Okay, that's Jerry Lawler. And I think it was Dave Meltzer who said that this was a move that WWE has wanted to make for a while now, moving Lawler off of Raw, possibly as far back as when Lawler had the heart attack. And his being out with the diverticulitis last week just gave them the opening they needed to boot him and to move him onto the other show. Now you know why guys don't take any time off and they work through injuries. Even the announcers are not safe. You take one day off, you take 1 week off, and you lose your spot. That's how it works. I am happy for Byron Saxton getting a shot. I had the chance to meet him, get a picture with him. I chatted with him for a little bit at Fan Access and Mania last year. He's a good dude. I was also happy, though, for Tom Phillips getting a shot, and they gave him, what, 2 months? Three? How long was he on SmackDown for as the play-by-play guy? And now he's booted off SmackDown unceremoniously. I don't think he's fired. He's just not on SmackDown anymore. I feel bad for the guy. You know, he never had a chance. You train the guy on NXT for whatever it was, a year, 2 years. He got a shot at it when they shit-canned, Tony Dawson. And so he's in NXT for a while, you're training him, he's learning his craft, and then you promote the guy. They made a big deal about it. All the other wrestlers and all the other NXT people I remember on Twitter were sending him messages of congratulations, and it was like, I'm sure it was a big deal for him. And then you just bump him off the show a couple months later. How is anybody supposed to find their groove if you don't give him a chance? But, you know, one man's loss is another man's gain. So good for Byron Saxton. He's going to get a shot now. I don't watch much of SmackDown anyway, so it gets Lawler off the announce team for me, off my television, so I'm perfectly happy with it. It's a good day. It's a good day. It's a new day. How about that? I see people shitting on Booker T. Let's see how it goes, okay? Let's see how he does. I still haven't forgiven him for ruining the moment when Christian won the world title in that ladder match against Del Rio, but that was 4 years ago. Let's see how he does here. I do think people are missing the point, though, which is that none of this really matters. It's all well and good. I am happy I won't have to listen to Lawler on Monday nights. Okay, that's a positive. I'm happy about that. But none of this really matters. I said this a few weeks ago. In the grand scheme of things, absolutely none of this matters because Vince McMahon is still producing them. And as long as Vince McMahon is producing these guys and he's micromanaging every little thing, nothing will ever change. Nothing. I got a nice laugh when Taz interviewed Edge on his new podcast this week. And he asked Edge, because, you know, Edge was recently the guest host of Monday Night Raw, and he hasn't been back in a while. So Edge was back in WWE for one night. And he asked him, you know, he said, how was it? How was it being back there? How was it in the locker room? How have things changed? And Edge said that they micromanage things even more now. And Taz's reaction was just priceless. His reaction to that was just hilarious. He didn't think it was possible that they could micromanage things any more than they already do. Even when Taz was there. And Taz hasn't been in the company for years. Here's what I don't understand. Why do we need three announcers on both shows? What is this fetish that they have, all of a sudden in the last few years, for having an announced trio instead of an announced duo? Where did this come from? How did this start? Whatever happened to the two-man booth? On NXT, I can at least kind of understand it. You know, it's their training ground. You got to, you know, get as many people on there as possible. They need experience. Okay, I get that. Why must either of these shows have a three-man booth, let alone both? The best three-man booth anywhere in the world right now is here in New York, okay? If the Mets have nothing else going for them, and very rarely do the New York Mets have anything going for them, anything positive anyway, but if they've got nothing else going for them, they at least can say that they have the best announced team. Gary Cohen, Ron Darling, Keith Hernandez, best team in sports. I think even if you're not a sports fan, if you listen to these guys, you would like them. If they really wanted to improve their show, they'd sign those guys away from the Mets. The fact that they know next to nothing about pro wrestling doesn't even matter. Neither does WWE. Now, I saw this report that was attributed to Wade Keller of The Torch about WWE apparently is giving serious consideration to a soft brand split, with some talent being exclusive to Raw and some being exclusive to SmackDown. I don't like this idea at all. I see a lot of people, oh, this is great, bring back the brand split. People are out of your minds, okay? I was very, very happy when they stopped pretending that they actually had a brand split, because there hasn't been a real brand split in WWE in 10 years, at least. These people don't know how to do a real brand split. What is a soft split, anyway? What does that even mean? You're either all in or you're not. You can't be half pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. A soft split is what they had before, and it didn't work. If you're going to do a real brand split, then do it right. It has to have its own production style, not influenced by Kevin Dunn, its own talent, its own announcers. You can't have Michael Cole double-dipping on Raw and SmackDown. Okay, it's its own storylines you need, its own special events, and then you can build maybe to a super show between the two brands down the road. That's the only way you can do this right. I was watching Lucha Underground, and I see Masquerita Sagrada, the little dude, and it reminded me of an idea that I pitched a while back. And it might have actually been before Raw went to 3 hours, when they announced that they were moving to 3 hours, and I was talking about different ways that they can make the show special, how to make 3 hours work. Of course, they did none of this. Why not have a real minis division, exclusive to SmackDown? Okay, not that shit that they had in 2006 with Super Porky and all that stuff, and they made it into a joke, and then they got rid of it 2 months later. If you're going to make it into a joke, then don't fucking do it. I'm talking about a real minis division. They've got El Torito in a bull costume. The guy is actually one of the more amazing talents that they have under contract right now, but you would never know it. And I said that at that time when they brought him in. I said, boy, if you look at some of the stuff that this guy has done on YouTube down in Mexico, boy, if they use this guy, they could build a whole division around this guy. This guy is amazing to watch. It would be nice 5, 10, 15 minutes out of the week on a 3-hour show to give us a little something different instead of the status quo. Of course, like I said, they didn't do that. And instead, he's been, you know, he's been part of, I can't even say a mid-card act. Would you consider Los Matadores a mid-card act? Because I don't. They're a lower-card act. And he comes out, and they do comedy with him and Hornswoggle, because that's what they do. Ah, they're midgets, so we have to do comedy. And he's been completely underutilized. You can build a whole fucking division around this guy. So why not do it? Why not make him the face of the division? The cruiserweights. I'm not really a fan of it anymore because those guys, you know, what they would do with a cruiserweight division, my fear, is they would take a guy like an Adrian Neville, or they would take a guy like a Finn Balor. I don't think they would do it with him necessarily, but once you do that, once you take guys like that, who can be so much better, you know, you brand them a certain way, they're typecast at that point as a cruiserweight. That's how the people look at them, and I don't think that's good for anybody. I don't think it's good for those guys especially. But you could sign some guys to build a division around and make it something unique to the brand. Only on SmackDown you can see the cruiserweights. You know, but you've got 3 hours of Raw on Monday nights. I don't know why they don't give us a little more variety on that show, but you can make that stuff exclusive to SmackDown to really make it stand out more. Instead, you're going to do a soft split and cut your roster in half, a roster that already lacks a lot of depth, for a 3-hour show. You're going to cut your roster in half for a 3-hour show. That makes sense. That is a terrible idea. And I agree, it would be nice if SmackDown had its own identity. I'm the one who always says SmackDown is a useless show. And it is. And it actually makes people angry when I say that. Like I'm offending, oh, SmackDown has some great wrestling. I'm not saying SmackDown doesn't sometimes have great wrestling, okay? So does Raw sometimes. But SmackDown is a useless show, by and large. Now, this week, Daniel Bryan's going to be on SmackDown. SmackDown, for once, will not be a useless show. Of course. Of course, they're moving to Thursday, so they're going to make SmackDown for the first week and the second week and maybe even the third week mean something more. And then by week 4 or week 6, it's going to be right back where it was. I guarantee you it will be right back where it was. They did the same thing when they debuted Main Event on ION Television. And the very first main event on Main Event was CM Punk against Sheamus, which I think at that time was a champion versus champion match. So they loaded up that first show. I think they loaded up the next few shows. And eventually Main Event settled into being what it is today, which is a show that will probably have some really good wrestling, but it's a nothing show. No storylines are really ever progressed. It's not must-see television in any way. It's just more television time for them to fill. And that's what SmackDown is. And that's what SmackDown will always be. But I agree. It would be nice if SmackDown had its own identity and it wasn't a Raw rematch show. They should absolutely make changes to the show. But a soft brand split will fail. Mark my words. It will fail. And I have no interest in seeing it. Speaking of things I have no interest in seeing, Monday Night Raw this past week was from Corpus Christi, Texas, traditionally one of the poorer crowds they have for their TV shows. I don't know why, but it is. It's one of the worst crowds that they usually have. Dean Ambrose and Bray Wyatt had a good brawl. Okay, mystifying finish, but a good brawl still. Aside from that, I hated this show with a passion. I am so happy that I had that Wrestle Kingdom show to rave about because, again, it takes away the ammunition from the people who are going to hear this review and they're going to want to throw it in my face that I never have anything positive to say and I'm just a hater, blah, blah, blah. And now they can't say that, so I'm very anxious what their argument is going to be. This was a horrible way to start the new year. And coming off that New Japan show, you know, I see a lot of people mentioning that. How do you go from that to this in the span of 24 hours if you were like me and you watched the replay of the New Japan show? Let me tell you something, okay? Wrestle Kingdom was their version of WrestleMania. Not once did you see me on Twitter comparing the two shows, because it's not fair. It really is not fair. You can't compare. It's like comparing WrestleMania to a fucking episode of Impact. Of course, WrestleMania is going to be better than Impact. So it's not as though I came into Raw Monday night thinking, man, this show's going to blow me away like the New Japan show did. That's not what I was expecting. If you were expecting it, then you were expecting way too much. But here's the thing, okay? You didn't need to compare this show to the New Japan show to realize, okay, that this show was no good. This could have been the only wrestling show on television all week, and it still would have sucked. So I wasn't surprised at all when I read that Vince McMahon threw the script out, apparently at 3 o'clock in the afternoon that day, and rewrote the entire show himself. What I want to know is, what was so bad about that show that we ended up with this one? How much worse could that show have possibly been? Holy shit. I hope to God that original script ends up leaking somewhere because it would make for great reading material. So, we open the show. It's worth noting we have a new intro video and pyro. I can't remember the last time they actually played the video, the intro video, and had any kind of pyro to open the show. They've had cold opens now for like over a year. So that was kind of a nice little change of pace. That actually had me thinking, okay, this show's going to feel fresh in some way. It's a new year. We actually had a video. We had pyro. This is different. It's not going to open with the same authority promo. Of course, I'm an idiot for thinking that. It was interesting to see Roman Reigns, not John Cena anymore, as the final person featured in that new open. So we have all the wrestlers in the ring with John Cena, including Darren Young, looking way more badass with facial hair. Hell of a way, by the way, to make your return from a major injury, just kind of standing there in the background, not one mention by the announcers. So Cena's out there, he apologizes for bringing back the authority comes out, they reward Seth Rollins by adding him to the match at the Royal Rumble for the championship, and they declare this John Cena Appreciation Night. The first Raw of 2015, and it's a John Cena Appreciation Night. I want to know, how is that any different from any other week on this show? So now the Royal Rumble main event is Cena, Lesnar, and Rollins in a triple threat for the WWE title. The positive to Rollins being added to that match is that at least it makes for a slightly different match than just John Cena versus Brock Lesnar one-on-one again. It's the first multi-man match that Brock's been in probably in more than a decade. It's a big spot for Rollins to be in. I think he'll make the match better. Although I can't shake the feeling he's just in there to take the losing fall so that Brock doesn't have to get pinned or so John Cena doesn't have to lose clean. I said, there's no way Cena's losing clean again after SummerSlam to this guy. I still expect him to win the title, but maybe Rollins then cashes in and wins it anyway. Somebody joked on Twitter that Seth wins the title at the Rumble, then wins the Rumble match, then cashes in at WrestleMania, so it's a Seth versus Seth match at Mania. I'll tell you what, that would be a hell of a main event if they could pull that off somehow. I just got done watching Kota Ibushi in some video on Dailymotion for the DDT promotion wrestling a blow-up doll a few years ago in a 30-minute match. This was not like a 5 or 10-minute match. This was a 30-minute match he wrestled against Yoshihiko the blow-up doll. And by the end of that match, I was popping for all the big moves. It was a fucking blow-up doll. But when you're that talented, you can make stuff like that work. I think Seth can wrestle himself at WrestleMania and do just fine. So the Authority was out to punish the members of Team Cena on this show, starting with Dolph Ziggler putting his Intercontinental title on the line against the former champion Bad News Barrett. He was a babyface, Barrett was, in his return, but now he's back to being a heel again. The match went 2 minutes. Dolph Ziggler got a surprise pinfall. Barrett killed him dead after the match. He threw him all over the ringside area like a rag doll, into the barricades, into the steps, into the post. Dementia Kane comes out, says that he forgot to tell Dolph that this is a 2 out of 3 falls match. So they wrestle a little bit longer. Dolph is so good. He's got the crowd behind him now, as he always does. They're into the near falls. It actually turns into a pretty competitive match. Dolph lays out Barrett with a super kick. Kane gets up on the apron. He eats a super kick, but then he turns around into a bullhammer elbow, and Barrett gets the pin. We're told that Wade Barrett is now a 5-time Intercontinental Champion. 5 times. How is that even possible? I barely remember 2 of those title wins. Remember when Razor Ramon won the Intercontinental title for a 4th time? I think he beat Dean Douglas for it. Nobody had ever done that before. It actually felt like a big deal. When you won a title back then, like the 3rd time, maybe the 4th time, it was like a huge deal. I could remember every single one of those title wins that Scott Hall had. Now, I can barely remember 2 of them, and this fucker's got 5 titles. The good thing about Ziggler losing is that nobody has ever won the Royal Rumble while holding the Intercontinental title, not even Roddy Piper. So it paves the way, in theory, for bigger and better things for Dolph. Plus, the title is like a death trap for most guys. Poor Wade Barrett, he wins the title. The very next night at the SmackDown tapings, he loses clean in a non-title match to Sin Cara. Sin Cara, one half of the NXT Tag Team Champions. You can't make this shit up. Maybe on Raw Monday, who knows? Maybe it'll be Dolph under the Sin Cara mask, and that, you know, that storyline will play into this. But right now, Wade Barrett got beat by Sin Cara. That's all I know. First night as the Intercontinental Champion, he got beat. Remember, people, I keep telling you this over and over again. Champs are chumps. Get that shit trending. Champs are chumps. That is one thing that did strike me again after the New Japan show, and I'm not going to go into it again, but there it is, right there, right in front of your face. The difference in how championships are presented there as opposed to how championships are presented here. It's just a different philosophy. I think it's a bad philosophy. I just don't understand the logic behind it. I don't get it. I don't understand it. Anything you can do to make these guys feel more special, you should be doing. Wade Barrett just came back from an injury. He's going to need all the help he can get in getting back up to that level that he was at before. This does him no favors. You're doing him a disservice by doing that. I don't know why you would do that. I just don't get it. I don't understand. Why? I mean, can you imagine a John Cena or a Sheamus or somebody weeping after losing a major championship match? I mean, why would he? Why would anybody in this company? You're just going to get a rematch anyway. I mean, at least they put the U.S. title on Rusev. He's still undefeated, although he was getting a push long before they put the belt on him. But, I mean, at least that's something, I guess. Although that title doesn't feel any more special to me at all either. He's had it now for a few months. It still is just another piece of tin. Roman Reigns. Oh, boy. Roman Reigns. They had Roman Reigns in the back with Renee Young doing a quick promo. This was the Roman Reigns Superman promo. He talked about how he can leap tall buildings in a single bound using all these old Superman cliches. And then on SmackDown, he channeled his inner Daffy Duck, or Sylvester the Cat. Suffering succotash, he said. I haven't heard that expression since I was 12. Suffering succotash. And then he said how hard that was to say, and he looked into the hard camera and he winked. as if to acknowledge how shitty this material is. They've now incorporated it into his gimmick, how bad this material is. It's become a punchline. Believe me, he didn't wink on his own, people. I am amazed. I am amazed at the people on YouTube. Like, I'm looking at the comment sections, and people are like, oh, Roman Reigns, man, that's a little wink for the IWC. Ha ha ha! And it's like, are you people out of your mind? Do you think... Look, anybody who goes out there and does anything on television, especially these newer guys who are just first getting a push, they don't want to fuck up, they don't want to say the wrong thing. Everybody's afraid. Steve Austin said it. Everybody's afraid of their own shadow. Everything's overscripted. Do you honestly think that Roman Reigns would look into the hard camera, they'd be perfectly positioned to get him on camera, and he would wink on his own? There is not a damn thing that he's doing out there that isn't rubber stamped by Vince McMahon. This is not Roman Reigns going into business for himself and acknowledging how crappy the material is. This is WWE acknowledging how crappy their own material is. And by the way, Vince McMahon apparently is the one scripting this stuff himself. He is personally scripting Roman Reigns' material himself. And I said before, I made the comment a few weeks ago that whoever is scripting this shit ought to be fired. I stand by that. Because if they don't do something about this quickly, they're going to ruin this guy for good. Roman Reigns could be the next big thing. I know a lot of people would disagree with me on that. They think I'm nuts for saying that. But it's going to be him. Okay, and he's got the tools and he can get better, but you're ruining him. You're ruining him by doing this, and you keep doing it, and you're going to pass that point of no return. They are sabotaging this guy. And they acknowledge that they're sabotaging this guy by doing stuff like that winking shit. They know it, and they still do it. At what point does he come out and cut a Porky Pig promo? That's what I'm surprised I haven't done that already. Porky Pig used to come out and go, oh, bidi, 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 bidi. That's all, folks. How long before we see Roman Reigns out there going, bidi, 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 that. Bidi, that. From that, we go to the Ascension. I got something to say about this, too. The Ascension comes out. They cut a shitty promo mocking Demolition, mocking the Road Warriors. Oh, what a joke, they say. Then they beat up two jobbers in a quick squash. Whoever scripted this shit for them should also be fired. Wouldn't shock me if Vince McMahon was doing the Ascension's promos too. The announcers then proceeded during the match, after they finished cutting the promo, to absolutely bury the Ascension on commentary. JBL said they couldn't even carry the Road Warriors back. You listen to this, you would think the Road Warriors were coming back for a match to put the Ascension over. The only problem with that is one half of the Road Warriors are dead. And he's been dead for over a decade. So there will be no match. And it's like I said earlier, you know, JBL is the closest thing they have to a heel wrestling announcer. This was not Jerry Lawler, Michael Cole, Booker T, whoever was on commentary this week making a comment like that. Of all people, it was JBL. The guy on the announce team you would least expect to make a comment like that. And if this was designed to somehow get these guys over, get heat on them, and not to bury them, then it failed. It blew up in their face. It did not work. And there was a lot of very angry people watching this. And I want to talk about this because Lance Storm, he turned the show off. He was severely offended at what he took as a sign of disrespect at Hawk, who's dead, who was a friend of his, and who's no longer around to defend himself. Shane Helms felt the same way. Mick Foley was also offended by their treatment of Hawk. And especially that line about, oh, what a joke, you know, mocking, that was Hawk's catchphrase. The weird thing about this was, I was not offended, but at the same time, I'm not a wrestler. I was not friendly with Hawk. Foley may have been friendly with Hawk. Lance Storm said he was friendly with Hawk. I don't know about Shane Helms. They're wrestlers, they were offended by it. If anything, they're the ones who I would think would be like, come on, guys, it's a work. What are you getting so offended by? It's heat. Come on, it's called being a heel. But no, they were very upset. By how this whole thing came about, and Road Warrior Animal ended up coming out and making a statement about it on Facebook, and you know, he basically said the idiots in charge make the call. Everybody knows how stupid it is to copy the icons, and yet they still do it. You know, do it in a mocking fashion to get heat, I understand. Do it in a disrespectful way, well, that's another issue that's low and has no place in the business. again, my personal opinion, I was not offended by the slight against Hawk and the Road Warriors. I was offended by how crappy this whole thing was. This sucked. This was terrible. And I think Animal makes a very good point, though, in you do these guys no favors by having them copy off Icons. As soon as they had that first vignette where they said, oh, we're coming to Raw soon, we're coming soon, and they put the face paint on them, which they never had in NXT. I mean, even in NXT, there were people who would make oh, obviously they're supposed to be a modern-day incarnation of the LOD, but it's not like they came out mocking the LOD's catchphrase, wearing Hawk's old face paint. You know, they were just two big guys who came out. They were kind of like a modern-day version, you know, maybe of LOD or the Eliminators in ECW. They stole the Eliminators' finish. They don't do it as well as the Eliminators did. But now they put the face paint on them, and then they have them going out there week after week, openly acknowledging the fact that they're copying off Demolition, and openly acknowledging the fact that they're copying off LOD. So naturally, people will make the comparisons. There is no comparison. These guys are dead in the water. They're doing them no favors. You know, it'd be like David Flair. When David Flair started wrestling in WCW, they didn't hide from the fact that he was Ric Flair's son. It kind of became part of who he, oh, it's Ric Flair's son. There was no way he was ever going to be able to live up to Ric Flair. And before long, David Flair was out of the wrestling business. Now, maybe they can get away with it with Charlotte. They openly acknowledge that she's the daughter of Ric Flair, but Charlotte actually has some real talent. You know? So that's a little bit different. Plus, it's you know, women's wrestling, not male wrestling. It's not like Charlotte will ever get to the same level her dad was at. But, I mean, you're killing these guys before they have a chance to get over by coming out of the gate and comparing them to guys that they simply cannot compare to. I think Animal makes a very good point in that respect. So they were really offended by this disrespect to Hawk, and they're entitled to feel that way. I wasn't bothered by that. I was just bothered by how terrible this whole thing was. From the promo, to the way the announcers buried them, to the match itself, everything about this was bad. The only good thing I can honestly say about this segment and how this all went off was I have not heard Demolition's name mentioned on WWE television in forever, until the last couple of weeks. So if any good might come out of this, it's that Demolition may finally get a Hall of Fame induction this year, which I think they're well overdue for. LOD is in. Demolition deserves to be in, too. If the only good thing that comes out of this is a Hall of Fame induction for them, then that's fine. But that's the only good thing that I could see coming from this. Then we had Roman Reigns and The Big Show. The rematch of their original match from a few weeks ago with that terrible finish. Big Show hit Roman Reigns with the ring steps for yet another DQ finish, WWE's favorite finish. He brought him back into the ring. He was about to hit him with the stairs again when Reigns speared him. The steps supposedly fell on top of Big Show's head. They didn't, but he was sure to position them that way after he landed. And then the officials checked on him, and that was that. We better not be getting a stairs match between these two. That's all I can say. What is Big Show's infatuation with the ring steps all of a sudden anyway? He knocked out Mark Henry in the first 30 seconds of the main event of Survivor Series with a knockout punch. Why doesn't he just punch Reigns in the face instead of lugging those steps around all over the place? This guy is not too bright. Natalya pinned Nikki Bella in a non-title match, 1 minute 17 seconds. That's what they give the Divas division on Raw now, 1 minute and 17 seconds, with a distraction roll-up. Our first of the new year, and we were not even done yet on this show. Somebody needs to start a counter for me. I don't care who it is. Brian Bird, somebody please start a counter for distraction roll-up finishes in 2015 on WWE television. That's two on this show so far, just on this show alone. We need to track this for the rest of the year. Paige was out in Natty's corner because of the Total Divas, I guess. Now they're... Are they supposed to be best friends? I don't know. I read some description of that first episode, by the way. Apparently, Paige gave Natty like a pot brownie that turned out to not be a pot brownie, but Natalya was freaking out because she was being drug tested randomly. How she would know if it was random, I have no idea. This show jumped the shark a long time ago. It's comical, actually, to read the descriptions of some of these shows, some of these episodes. I fully expect Total Divas to be off the air by next year, by the way. At least Paige got TV time. You know, she kicked both of the Bellas' asses when the match was over. I did hear that Paige and Nikki had a really good long match on Main Event. You all heard my rant on this a few weeks ago. I'm not going to rehash it. I haven't seen the match. They couldn't give those two 10 minutes on the 3-hour show. And that's the show I'm reviewing. So the joke's on me, I guess. I'm happy they got the match. It's just why that couldn't be on Raw is just beyond my comprehension. Luke Harper beat Eric Rowan with the Lariat, with J&J Security as the special referees, Eric Rowan being screwed over for his role on Team Cena at Survivor Series. The show was really dragging by this point. I figured maybe it was so lackluster because they were saving some big angle for the end of the show. Boy, was I wrong. We had Bray Wyatt and Dean Ambrose in an ambulance match. Bray Wyatt beat Dean Ambrose yet again, because that's what he does. There was one fun diving elbow spot. Ambrose had Wyatt on a table down below. He jumped off the roof of the ambulance through the table, so that was fun. But Dean Ambrose loses yet another big match. And I, you know, between the Seth Rollins program and now the Bray Wyatt program, at what point does Ambrose get that big win is what I want to know. How long can you wait before you completely cool the guy off? Makes me think they really are making Wyatt strong for The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And you know my feelings on that match. It's not a match I really care to see. The Usos and Naomi against The Miz, Ms. Dow, and Alicia Fox. A distraction roll-up finish with Miz pinning Jimmy after Jimmy narrowly avoided ramming into his wife and knocking her off the apron. Somehow this distracted him. He didn't actually collide with her. He almost did. But this was enough to distract him and allowed Miz to roll him up. That's two distraction finishes on the same show, distraction roll-ups, that is. This one actually does play into the story, assuming it leads to problems between Jimmy and Naomi. But they use the finish so goddamn often that it means nothing. So even when it's appropriate to use the finish, it's like, ugh, another one. Ryback against Seth Rollins. Amnesia Kane came back out and said, God, you know, I forgot to tell you that this is a handicap match with myself and Rollins against Ryback. Ryback tried, but his last name is not Cena, so he was unable to overcome the odds here. Ate two curb stomps from Rollins and was pinned. I like Kane, okay? I really do. I actually like the big guy. But I'm hoping next week we get Magician Kane and he makes himself disappear, because I am completely tired of his corporate shtick at this point. Adam Rose and Big E were having a match when Cesaro and Tyson Kidd ran in wearing leotards and laid out Big E with a powerbomb blockbuster combo in the corner, then ripped off their masks to reveal their real identities. Or in the case of Cesaro, poor guy couldn't get it off. He couldn't get the mask off. So he just tore it open the way that Hulk Hogan used to tear open his t-shirts. I feel bad for the New Day guys, I really do. I mean, already back to mid-card fodder. Nobody cares about them at all. The reaction when they came out here was just pathetic. I guess it didn't help they were in the death spot, you know, 2.5 hours into a 3-hour show, but nobody cares. I told you this was going to happen. I told you. We then had the John Cena appreciation ceremony with Triple H and Stephanie McMahon. They called out Ryback, Rowan, Ziggler. They teased suspending each of them, and then instead they fired all of them. And then they said that they all had John Cena to thank for them losing their jobs, while confetti and balloons fell from the ceiling, and they played the same music they played when Lex Luger beat Yokozuna by countout that one year at SummerSlam. Again, I just condensed a 20-minute segment into about 90 seconds. I wish WWE could do that more often. The finish, you know, here made the baby faces look about as good as that finish actually made Lex Luger look back in 93, which is to say that it made them look like idiots. This sucked. Besides the fact that we opened the show with an authority promo and ended the show with an authority promo, you want to know why this finish sucked? You want to know why this finish fell so flat? Because there is not a single person with half a brain who could buy this firing stipulation. After WWE just got done telling you that the big stipulation for the Survivor Series main event meant nothing. Nothing. 4 weeks later, they just brought them back. It was rendered meaningless. That is the damage that is caused by building up stipulations that are never enforced. And I'll give you another reason why this sucked. And this is indicative of a much bigger problem, I think, at WWE right now. The babyfaces just stand there and take it. They just take the abuse. Everybody has been completely neutered on this show. And, you know, we know that Randy Orton is going to return and go after the Authority, most likely. We know that Sting is going to come back, and the Authority will eventually get its comeuppance. The story will eventually pay itself off. But your baby faces right now are a bunch of pussies. And I think it's a stretch for the people who run this company, who are maybe more obsessed over the Attitude Era and the Monday Night Wars than the fans are, who are constantly besieging us with Attitude Era DVDs and network specials. Hey, it's Attitude Week, everybody. Come watch back when we actually had guys that had two nuts between their legs. It's a stretch, I think, to put out a product now where they all just stand there and they take the abuse, and the fans are, you know, just waiting. They're waiting. They're begging for somebody to retaliate, verbally, physically, anything. For the love of God, do something. And nothing happens. It's not hard to see why people just have this feeling of apathy towards the product right now. I wanted to touch on something else here. This was posted in our Facebook group a few days ago. On some independent wrestling fan page, someone said that instead of moaning about WWE and the product, why not find a different brand of wrestling that you like? It's, you know, it's a simplistic argument I've heard pitched before, because, for example, I watch a ton of wrestling, okay, every single week. That doesn't mean that I have to give up on one product because I'm not allowed to vent about what's wrong with it and how to make it better. If that were the case, I would have given up on TNA a long time ago. But I bring this up because you guys, okay, you guys are smart. You know the score. Some of you guys pointed out another flaw in that argument, and I think it's relevant, especially coming off that New Japan show last weekend. Someone pointed out that that's all well and good, except that most wrestling fans will find that new product that they do like, and they'll just end up pirating it, which does more to hurt than to help the product. Fucking Lionheart, okay? The wrestler in the UK that broke his own neck on a Styles Clash because he didn't know what the fuck he was doing, he posted a link to a Wrestle Kingdom stream on his Twitter account. And then when one of the Young Bucks called him out on it and how it does nothing to help New Japan, he took it down. This guy is a wrestler. He is an independent wrestler. And he posts an illegal stream to the show on his own Twitter page. You can imagine how many fans did the same thing. For everyone who enjoyed that New Japan show and want to see more of it, you're not going to get it unless you support the product. I paid the $34.95 to watch that show, even though I could have gotten it for like $8 on New Japan World, on their streaming service, because I wanted the English commentary and I wanted to see the show do well and so we can get more of them this year. So if you are truly fed up with WWE and you're looking for an alternative, and they do exist, you've got lots of options out there, okay? The only way you're ever going to put pressure on WWE is to hit them where it hurts. And take that money away from them and give it to somebody else. You could start all the online petitions in the world. Let me tell you something. The petitions that people start, petitions are a joke. Petitions will get you nowhere. You'd be much better off taking your money that you would put towards WWE or the WWE Network or whatever t-shirt you buy from WWE shop. Take that money and put it towards something else, whether it's TNA, ROH, New Japan, your local indie, Lucha Underground, whatever. Whatever it is. Hit them where it hurts, if that's how you honestly feel. Sami Zayn returned to NXT this week. He was out there for a promo at the beginning of the show. He got a great reaction. Was talking about his Zaniacs. I guess that's what he's calling his fans. You know, between the fans chanting "You deserve it" at him and him doing the speech where he says that this title isn't mine, it belongs to all of you. You guys made this happen. This is right out of the Daniel Bryan 2014 playbook. I mean, almost a carbon copy of that opening segment the night after WrestleMania on Monday Night Raw. Not that that's a bad thing, but it's obvious that they're going with the same story. Adrian Neville came out to congratulate Sami. Sami teased giving him a rematch when William Regal came out and made it official. So next week it is Sami Zayn against Adrian Neville Part 2 for the NXT Championship, a rematch of what I thought was probably the match of the year in WWE last year, if we include NXT. No Kevin Owens on this show, but you know he's coming. He's lurking in the shadows, and I fully expect him to make an appearance in that match next week. Hideo Itami had a match with Curtis Axel. Curtis Axel back on NXT for the first time in a long time. Actually, I think the last time he was probably on the show, I'm guessing, he was probably still Michael McGillicuddy. And he actually had some very good matches back in the day. So he's trying to rejuvenate his career, as Tyson Kidd was able to do. And Itami beat Axel after blocking a perfect plex, delivered a karate kick to the back of the head. Itami desperately needs a finishing move. That kick just doesn't cut it for me. It's always so weird when he executes it. Like, the fans don't know that it's supposed to be the finish, so they don't really react big to it. Plus, you know, he does kicks for most of the match anyway, so the fact that his match would end with just like a random kick is not good. They were chanting GTS at him during the match, so that tells you right there what they want to see. I'm sure we'll get it at some point. Backstage, Tyson Kidd sent Natalya off to check on his cats, to FaceTime with them. Not their cats, his cats. He wanted to make that clear. Next week, he wrestles Finn Balor. He said his goal is to still become the NXT champion and then to replace Sarah McLachlan as the face of the ASPCA. As long as he doesn't start popping up in those depressing commercials. I can't even watch those when those come on. Next week, Bull Dempsey and Baron Corbin will finally meet one-on-one for the first time. The irresistible force meeting the immovable object, trademark Gorilla Monsoon. That's in addition to Kidd vs. Balor and Neville vs. Zayn, so they're loading up the show next week, their first Wednesday night show this week. NXT debuts Wednesdays at 9 p.m. because SmackDown is moving to Thursdays. I may watch that first SmackDown show this week, but after that, I'm sticking with NXT on Thursdays. That's my night. I've got my routine set. I'm not letting them ruin that routine. I'm not changing it. I'll just have to watch NXT on a one-day delay, that's all. Sasha Banks beat Alexa Bliss with her bank statement submission. Not really sure what's next for Sasha, seeing as how she lost twice to Charlotte, but they're keeping her strong. Tyler Breeze is back from his European vacation. He wrestled newcomer Chad Gable, who was very over with the crowd at Full Sail. I'm sure he's got to be doing non-televised matches there, because there's no way, you know, if this was his first appearance in a match, there's no reason for him to get the kind of reaction he got. So obviously he's been wrestling there for a while, but this was his televised debut. He does bear a slight resemblance to Kurt Angle with the tights, being an Olympian. He competed in the 2012 games. He looked impressive here, but he was felled by a beauty shot and pinned. Gable is, if you watch, not watch, but if you read up on any of the NXT house shows they do, because they run the circuit down in Florida, and they do these house shows in front of like 150, 200, 300 people. Gable on those shows is the leader of a group called Shoot Nation that they've been doing. So I'm very curious to see if they end up bringing that gimmick to TV. Shoot Nation, it's got Gable, it's got Jason Jordan, who's been one half of that team recently with Ty Dillinger. I think the other guys are new guys who have not yet debuted. So we'll see. We'll see if they bring it up to TV at some point. Backstage, Finn Balor said Tyson Kidd will need more than 9 lives to get past him next week. This guy says his dream opponent at WrestleMania is John Cena, which is a good answer to give. I mean, John Cena, God knows he's had plenty of WrestleMania main events. If I were in WWE, that would be my goal too, to work with John Cena. I predict that will happen. I predict that match will happen at WrestleMania 33. Mark it down right now. And LOL, Cena wins. Main event was the Lucha Dragons against the Vaude Villains in a takeover rematch for the NXT Tag Team Championship. Kind of a boring match, to be honest. I mean, maybe I'm being harsh. It was okay, just not at the level of a usual NXT main event. The finish was unique, at least. Sin Cara got Aiden English up in a powerbomb position, and Kalisto came off the top rope with a wacky twisting move for the pin, so the Lucha Dragons retained their tag team titles. And that was NXT. It was not the best of shows, but nothing really bad about it. It's still a relatively fun, easy hour of wrestling to watch. Next week, this week, I guess I should say, this Wednesday, that's going to be the big show. You got the championship main event. You've got Finn Balor and Tyson Kidd, which should be very good. And very curious to see this first Baron Corbin-Bull Dempsey match. Maybe it'll go 45 seconds. instead of the usual 20 or 30 that these Baron Corbin matches go. Again, we need to see him in longer matches to really get a gauge on how good this guy is, and hopefully they'll give them some time, so I'm looking forward to that. We are going to take a quick break here. We'll come back, and I have a lot of notes on Impact, their debut on Destination America this past week, and the tapings from Friday night that I was at, including the big, nasty bump that Jeff Hardy took. So we'll be back right after this. ProWrestlingTees.com is the new home for Sound Off shirts and apparel. Get your official Solomonster Sounds Off logo t-shirt and other assorted designs like the new Eat Sleep Sound Off Repeat shirt, which sounds an awful lot like a typical week for me. And I know it is for some of you guys as well. Now you can show your support for the podcast wherever you go by buying a shirt. Hell, buy two of them. Pro Wrestling Tees accepts PayPal as payment and ships internationally all over the world. The more shirts we sell, the more designs we'll be able to offer in the future, but we can only do that with your help. Be one of the first 25 people to buy a shirt, and you'll get a shout-out right here on the Sound Off. Visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff to go directly to our new store. That's ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. This was a big week for TNA. It was their premiere on Destination America. Or for probably most people going forward, Destination DVR, once the show moves to its new slot on Friday nights. I think it's Friday nights at 9. But this week it was on Wednesday night. They had a live-to-tape show, the first of what will be many from the Manhattan Center in New York City. And you needed night vision goggles on this first show to see the crowd. It was so dark. And I've read different things. I've read, you know, there was a poor crowd, so that's why they darkened it, and other people have said that, well, it was a production technique. It was John Gaborik. It was his call. It was, you know, to focus more of the attention on the ring. That sounds like horseshit to me. They had a bad crowd, and so they darkened the place. And it didn't look good. It didn't look good at all. But I thought the opening video for the show was actually really cool. The music and the video, and they did this deal where all the heels and the baby faces kind of met face-to-face outside the Manhattan Center, and they started brawling, and they brawled into the building, and somehow they managed to brawl all the way up 8 flights of stairs, because it was not in the Hammerstein. If you know the Manhattan Center, when you first go into the building on the lower level, that's where the Hammerstein Ballroom is. The Grand Ballroom, which is where Monday Night Raw used to be taped back in 93, and where TNA now tapes, because there's no way they could afford the Hammerstein, is up on the 8th floor. So somehow they brawled all the way up 8 flights of stairs into the arena, and that's kind of how the show opened. They're, you know, in the aisleway, they're at ringside, everyone's fighting, everyone's brawling. I don't know, I thought it was a unique way to open the show, but the intro video was actually really cool. We had Josh Matthews on commentary making his TNA debut. Mike Tenay has been relegated to their secondary show and more of an analyst role, which is, I think, the role, frankly, that suits him the best. And they needed a change, and they brought in Josh, and it did freshen the show up a little bit, which I think is exactly what it needed. I thought Josh Matthews was fine. I thought, you know, he played off Taz very well. I think as time goes on, they'll gel even more. And I think they'll settle in as a pretty good announce team. I just think, you know, the move to get Tenay off that show was long overdue. And no offense to Mike Tenay, I just was tired of hearing him. And he is kind of the face of the old TNA, and this was supposed to be a fresh start for TNA. So as far as putting Matthews in there, yes, it was fresh. Was this show a fresh start, though, for TNA? No, it was not. It was the same old TNA, and if you're a big TNA fan, then that probably made you happy. And if you're not a TNA fan, or if you were just hoping that something, you know, would be different, the only thing that's different is the network, because everything else is the same. Actually, if anything, the production was worse. Between the darkening of the building and the shoddy camera work, which is not entirely their fault. I don't think there were production issues that they had. If you're a production guy, you know, you're having issues, you're probably freaking out. I'm sure it was a tough time for all of them. So I have some sympathy on them for that. They made the best of a bad situation. They were using equipment from the building and not their own, and it failed on them, and they're very fortunate the show really wasn't live, because if it was, it would have been bad times for TNA. But there was a lot of shoddy camera work. I mean, lots of missed shots, including Jeremy Borash slapping EC3 in the face, which the camera missed to show us a shot, I shit you not, of Brodus Clay's thigh. His thigh is what we saw. At the exact moment the slap happened, they switched to his thigh. So, that was quite the camera angle there. Speaking of angle, Kurt Angle made an announcement on the show. His big announcement was that he has resigned as the executive authority figure, whatever his fucking title was, in TNA. He is now back to being a wrestler. And his last act as the authority figure was to make a street fight between himself and MVP. So they opened the show with a street fight. They wrestled in their clothes. What was interesting about this was before the match, before the brawl began, they were jaw-jacking back and forth. They were doing a promo. And MVP has a lot of heat in New York. I will say that. The people do not like MVP. And they kept chanting, "Shut the fuck up." And Destination America muted the audio. This was their way of editing. They muted the audio every time the fans said, "Shut the fuck up." And they did it so many times that it sounded like they were having audio issues. It sounded terrible. So my suggestion to them is, if you're going to mute the audio, you got to find a better way to do it. Maybe it's a quick beep. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the beeping would be just as annoying. But when you just cut the audio out every 2 seconds, it just makes the show sound like amateur hour. So I guess Destination America, unlike Spike TV, is more of a PG network. And you can't get away with stuff like that. Wait until I get to the tapings, the spoilers for Friday night and what happened with MVP there. So Angle and MVP had a street fight. Kurt won clean with the Angle Slam. Pretty good. Pretty good brawl. Pretty good match. There was some Japanese influence there from MVP, who, of course, is a big fan of Japanese wrestling. He wrestled in Japan. As a matter of fact, that New Japan Intercontinental title I mentioned earlier that was so was built up in such a big way on that New Japan show last weekend, the very first Intercontinental champion was MVP. It's a relatively new title. It's only been a few years old. And when MVP went over to wrestle in Japan, he actually won a tournament to become the first Intercontinental champion. So a little trivia note there for you. So I guess with Kurt Angle back wrestling again, we are left without an authority figure in TNA. And all I can say is this. If this ends up with Dixie Carter coming back on the air as a regular character, then I just throw my hands up. I honestly don't know if I can handle that again. I might have to rethink my position on watching TNA every week. So hopefully, that is not how this ends up. James Storm and Abyss retained their tag team titles over the Wolves. Manic and the Great Sonata interfered, which caused the Hardys to run in and even out the odds. The Hardys were out there in the aisleway scouting. So they ran down, even out the odds, but there was a miscommunication with the Hardys that led to the Wolves losing, so that sets up the match between the Hardys and the Wolves on the show coming up this Friday. We had an angle with Jeremy Borash, Rockstar Spud, EC3, and Tyrus, the former Brodus Clay. Remember, Borash and Spud supposedly are the best of friends, and they're all out there. Borash makes the mistake of slapping EC3, which ends up with them roughing up Borash and EC3, shaving Jeremy Borash's head. Not completely bald, although apparently after the show, Borash finished the job himself. And I can vouch, having been at the tapings on Friday, that while there is some stubble on his head, he is now bald. And I don't know if that's the best look for Jeremy Borash. We'll see if he lets his hair grow back in. But that was the big angle with them on this show, to get some heat on EC3, who can't wrestle right now. Remember, he tore his tricep, I think. He had surgery, so I don't know when he's going to be able to come back. They haven't acknowledged it on TV. He was just out there in a suit. They didn't mention that he was hurt, but I don't think he'll be wrestling for a while yet. Austin Aries beat Low Ki to win back the X Division title with the Brain Buster. Fun match. Best one on the whole show. But it only went about 6 or 7 minutes. Wasn't a long match. Taryn Terrell won an 8-woman Battle Royal with Gail Kim, Rebel, Velvet Sky, Angelina Love, Madison Rain, and Havoc to retain her Knockouts title. After the match, Havoc beat the crap out of Taryn until Awesome Kong made her TNA return. Referees broke it up. Kong gave one of the referees a very stiff-looking chokeslam. This easily got the best response in the entire show. Kong was over like gangbusters. She looked like the Kong of old. I mean, I remember seeing photos of her. She got like a makeover. She lost some weight. She actually looked kind of weird. This is the way Awesome Kong should look. She looked like the Kong of old, just a big mountain of a woman that you wouldn't want to fuck with. I'm just sad she never got a proper run as the Karma character in WWE. I still don't know what the hell happened there. But at least here, we'll get to see the inevitable Kong vs. Gail Kim feud again. At least I hope so. That kind of put the knockouts division on the map for TNA back in the day. Main event was Lashley and Bobby Roode for the TNA World Heavyweight title. Lashley Roode 3. Lashley won back the TNA World Heavyweight Championship after Low-Key, Eric Young, and Samoa Joe ran in to interfere. They have all turned heel, although maybe Low-Key was already a heel. But Eric Young and Samoa Joe were definitely not heels. They are not only heels, they turned on Bobby Roode. Of course, Eric Young and Bobby Roode, supposedly the best of friends. You're not allowed to have a best friend in wrestling. If you are a wrestler, and you ever find yourself in a situation where you have a best friend, and you are best friends on television and bosom buddies, do not trust that friend. Keep them close, because they will turn on you. This will happen, I guarantee you. And it happened here to Bobby Roode, who lost the title. This came off to me, you know, when I watched this, this just came off as ridiculous to me. Because what is the rationale? And maybe we'll find out this week. I didn't read the results of the... They did two tapings that night. They did two more on Thursday. Entirely possible that we will get the promo on television this week explaining why Samoa Joe would turn on Bobby Roode, explaining why Eric Young would turn on Bobby Roode. Not even just turn on Bobby Roode, but align themselves with MVP. They're all now part of one big faction. MVP, Kenny King, Low-Key, Samoa Joe, and Eric Young are now called the Beatdown Clan. That is their name. BDK. The Beatdown Clan. Not the best faction name I've ever heard. So, why in the world would those guys turn on Roode and align with MVP? It just came off to me as they wanted a shocking ending to the show, and they do these turns that sometimes make absolutely no fucking sense, and that's what this felt like to me. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't positives to this, because I'm trying to look at the positives here. The positives should be obvious, and that is that Samoa Joe, and I don't really care much about Eric Young. His character is just played out to me at this point. I don't really care about Eric Young, but Samoa Joe and Low-Key, I mean, those are main event level talents right there that have not been featured in the main event for a long time. Actually, Low-Key has never really been featured in the main event of TNA. Being part of this new beatdown clan, this sounds so stupid, that name's got to go, but being part of this new beatdown clan, at least Samoa Joe and Low-Key are in the main event picture in TNA, and being at the tapings on Friday night, they were featured pretty prominently as far as the main event is concerned. That is a good thing, because Samoa Joe belongs in the main event. Now, Samoa Joe, you know, as a heel, I'm not saying he can't do it. He absolutely can do it, but he was so over as a babyface, I don't know why you would turn the guy. Low-Key, it doesn't matter. He may have already been a heel. Again, I don't really know what his alignment was in TNA. But that's the one positive out of this that I can say, is that at least those guys are going to be prominently positioned in the main event picture now, which they weren't before, and that's a good thing, because that's where they belong. But they ran in, there was a whole bunch of interference, they did the turns, and Lashley ended up getting the spear and got the pin. So that's how the show ended, and honestly, when the show was over, I gotta tell you, my impression of it was that nothing really changed. It's the same TNA, they went for the shock value finish, and we'll see how things progress from here. You know, their audience on Wednesday night was not great. For Destination America, I'm sure it was very good, but it was not good at all. It was actually less than 300,000 viewers. I said throw that number away. And it's true. Throw that number away, because Wednesday night is not their normal time slot. Friday night is going to be their night. I think Friday night is a death night, but Friday night, hey, SmackDown ended up doing very well on Fridays. Maybe TNA can take some of that audience now that SmackDown is no longer on Fridays. We'll see. But until they have a couple of weeks, 3 weeks in their normal time slot, then this number doesn't mean anything because it's not their normal night. But when it was over, that's how I felt. Same old TNA. You know, there's things I like about it. There's things I don't. The look, the feel, everything is pretty much as it was before. I can't say it's really an upgrade. If anything, it was a downgrade because I didn't think the production was as slick as it normally is. Maybe that had to do, again, the fact that their normal crew was not in charge. Maybe it will improve in the weeks to come. Now, I was at the TNA tapings on Friday night. They taped two shows that night, including their lockdown show. These shows will be airing on January 30th and February the 6th. That's going to be the lockdown show. Brian Blade and I were in the front row, so you may see us again on television. You know, we'll see. I kept my coat on the whole time because I had no fucking place to put it, so I'll be the guy. I'll be the one guy standing there in the front row wearing my my black pea coat. I had a great time. I really did. And I always say that. You know, I've been to a bunch of TNA shows. I've been to a bunch of TNA tapings in that building. I always have fun. It's always fun to be there live. I will say that one thing that TNA does, and Jeremy Borash deserves credit for this as well, because he's the one who's out there on the mic, they do a bang-up job revving that crowd up, doing, you know, using whatever little tricks they need to use to get that crowd hot, and they'll come and say, okay, we're about to, you know, tape a commercial for Destination America. You're all going to be on TV, so I'm going to count down, and you guys have to be loud, so everyone's going crazy. You know, a match will end, and before the next segment, they'll say, we're going to be back on television in 5, 4, and they'll do a thing where who's the loudest side of the building, and everybody's going crazy, and it sounds like the hottest crowd in the world. Now, granted, it's a lot easier for them to do that than it would be for WWE, because with TNA, you've got, like, I was going to say 500. Maybe that last night they did, absolutely. They actually had a pretty good crowd that last night. The earlier tapings, probably not so much, but you're dealing with, let's just say, 500 people. It's a lot easier for TNA to rev up those 500 fans than it would be for WWE to rev up a crowd of 6,500, okay, or 9,000 people. So TNA has an advantage in that respect, but they do a good job of it, so I'll give them credit, and I'll give Borash credit. They get the crowd amped up, and like I said, I had a blast. I had a good time. One person who did not have such a good time was Jeff Hardy. You've heard the story by now. TMZ ran with it. Jeff was legit knocked out in a spot that they did. Now, let's backtrack a little bit here. And there are going to be spoilers here. So I will say that. If you don't want to know any of the matches, any of the match results, anything having to do with an episode of Impact that has not yet aired, you'll need to skip ahead by a few minutes because there will be spoilers. So that's your warning. Jeff Hardy was involved in two different matches at the tapings. The first taping, of course, it's New York City, so we've got to have ourselves a Monsters Ball match with weapons and thumbtacks because we're in New York, and that's what New Yorkers like, right? That's the TNA mentality. So we had a Monsters Ball match between Jeff Hardy and Abyss, and Jeff Hardy won with the Swanton. There was a flying thumbtack in this match that went flying, almost hit me in the eye. I took a picture of it, put it up on my Twitter. So, yes, I almost owned TNA. Not that I want to, but I could have. So, I had a thumbtack as a gift. So, they had their Monsters Ball match, and Jeff comes back out later on at the lockdown taping, and it's Jeff Hardy and Matt Hardy against James Storm and Abyss for the tag team titles in a cage match. Now, Hardy and, or rather, Storm and Abyss retain the tag team titles. They're still the champions. But there is a spot at the end of the match where Jeff Hardy, he climbed up the cage. He's on top. And as he's trying to climb down, I guess, this may have been after the match was already over because they were, like, brawling all over the place and guys were going through tables. And so this may have been post-match. In fact, I'm sure it was. And Hardy ends up getting crushed. He slips, some guy was climbing up the cage. It was one of the members of Storm's Revolution faction. It was either Manic or that the Indian guy. What's his name? Mahabali Shera, whatever his name is. The guy is jacked, by the way, to the gills. That Indian guy, he's huge, and he's got tons of back knee. So maybe that's why he's so huge. So anyway, Hardy gets crushed. Okay, he's crushed on top of the cage door. And James Storm on the inside climbs the cage right next to Hardy. He's got a chain. And now here's what happened. So Hardy is crotched on the cage door. And as Storm is now on top and he's readying himself to whack Hardy upside the head with this chain, somebody swings the cage door. So Hardy's sitting on top of the cage door. And now it's swinging kind of towards the direction that James Storm is in, and Storm waffles him with the chain. Now, it's possible that what happened here is he was knocked out from the chain, and I'm not sure. I have no idea. But watching it, being there live and watching it, it's possible that where he gets knocked out is possibly while he was sitting on top of the cage door and when he got hit in the head. Maybe that's why when he fell, He didn't put his arms out or his hands out to brace himself, because when he tumbled off of the cage door, he just kind of fell off. He landed head and shoulder first on the steel steps. The steps were there because the cage was set up. So you kind of walk up, like, picture the Elimination Chamber, okay? So they have those steps that you walk up to get inside the cage. Normally, the steps are not there. Now, I've read different things. I've read conflicting things that the bump almost went off as planned, but the steps were not supposed to be there, or Hardy didn't realize the steps were there. I find that hard to believe, because the steps were there for every fucking match on that lockdown show, and everybody knew they were there, but they said, oh, Hardy was supposed to land on the floor. I don't know. To me, that I don't know that that would have been much better if he had landed on the floor. But he landed on the steps, and it made such a sickening thud. It was like, oh my God, like, how could this guy not be concussed after that? And then he kind of bounced off the steps, and he was just flat on his back on the floor. He looked like he was dead. I took a picture. He looked like he was dead. And supposedly he was legit knocked out, which I can believe. I mean, maybe we're being worked, okay? Maybe we're all being worked, but I can tell you, being there and seeing everyone's reaction, and Jeremy Borash, after Hardy had been taken to the back, coming back out and mouthing to a production, actually to the stage manager, mouthing to her that, you know, Hardy was out, you know. If it was a work, if every aspect of this was a work, then all of these people deserve an Academy Award. And there ain't nobody in TNA that I could see who deserves an Academy Award. So he got legit knocked out. Now, what happened is Hardy eventually, they were tending to him on the floor for a long time. He was probably down there for about 10 minutes. They didn't bring a stretcher out or anything. They actually picked him up, and they were helping him to the back, and Hardy put his hand in the air as if to acknowledge, I'm okay. And then James Storm attacked him again on the ramp. He attacked Hardy again. So that was the angle. And some of you pointed out, well, it sounds like maybe it was an injury angle to explain why he's not going to be on the UK tour. And that's a very good point, because TNA is going to the UK in the next few weeks. They've had this tour planned for a while. They're actually going to tape TV while they're there. And if you remember, Jeff Hardy has a criminal record. He's a felon. He is a convicted felon in this country. And I guess that precludes him from traveling to the UK. He is not allowed to travel to the UK, so he is not expected to be on that tour. And so it's just very convenient that they do this injury angle and Jeff Hardy is not going on the UK tour. Here's what I think. I think that, you know, this was the angle that they planned. Obviously, they planned this injury angle because he's not going to be on the tour, but in doing so, he legit got knocked out and hurt. Matt Hardy went on Twitter and was talking about how scary it was. Tommy Dreamer, of all people, posted a tweet about how scared he was when he saw Hardy, because Tommy Dreamer was there, and he was in the back, and he must have seen Jeff Hardy when he got taken back there. And Matt said that Jeff's going to go to the doctor. He's going to see a specialist this week to have his head examined. He's going to have a head scan and just make sure that everything is okay. Apparently, he's in a lot of pain. Not surprising. TMZ ran with the story. They said, according to their own sources, it is legit. He did legit get knocked out. He is going to go to the specialist and have his head scanned. And I could tell you, you know, when I watched it, I tweeted out. I said, Jeff Hardy is the craziest SOB I've ever seen. I could not even begin to describe at that time in 140 characters what had just happened. He's crazy. And there's no reason for Jeff Hardy to be taking bumps like this. The guy's almost 40 years old. He's a lot closer to 40 now than he is to 30. He's got a kid. He's in TNA, for Christ's sake. And I'm not saying that if he were working for WWE, then okay, it's okay for you to go out there and kill yourself. That's not what I'm saying. But still, you're in a building with 600 people. You're wrestling for TNA on a network, you know, God only knows how many people are going to watch that show on February 6th. And this guy is going out there, and he's killing himself. He's killing himself. Now, he didn't throw himself off the top of the cage like Mick Foley did. He didn't jump or dive or fall off the top of the cage. It was from the door. He was still a good height up there. It was more the impact of the fall that made that bump so brutal. I mean, we've seen a lot more spectacular bumps from people before. But unless you were there and you saw it live, and you've seen the video by now on Instagram, it was a sickening landing. And it made me shake my head, because this guy goes out there, and you can't say he doesn't give it his all. You can't say that Jeff Hardy is half-assing it because it ain't WWE. Some people said that about Rob Van Dam. Some people said that about Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan would walk out there on Impact every week. He looked like he could barely move when he would walk down the aisle. Now, not that he looks that much better, but it's interesting watching Hogan when he walks to the ring. I said that the very first time he showed up on Raw. He looked like he was moving a lot better. So guys go to TNA, and I don't doubt that there have been guys over time who take a very laissez-faire attitude. It's TNA, who cares? Jeff Hardy, you know, say what you want to about the guy. He doesn't take that approach. He goes out there. He's been there now for a long time, and he busts his ass. But, you know, you worry for a guy like that. He should not be taking bumps like that. Kurt Angle doing moonsaults off the top of the cage for TNA. These guys are fucking crazy. Thank God, you know, Angle was in a lockdown match on this taping. I thought for sure I was going to see a murder. You know, or a suicide, whatever you would call it. Thank God, you know, some people did go to the top of the cage. Kurt Angle was not one of them. Hopefully he's learned his lesson. So the Jeff Hardy thing, it was just very scary to watch. And he was down for a long time. And I hope, you know, he goes to the doctor. And if he is hurt, hopefully it's nothing more than a concussion. Even a concussion can be very serious. Hopefully he's not seriously hurt. But, you know, I looked over, and I think it was Brian Blade made the comment to me. Well, he'll tell me if I'm wrong. But we were talking about it, and, you know, it's amazing he's not already in a wheelchair, but Jeff Hardy is one of those guys that, you know, he's not 40 yet, but as he gets into his 40s, he makes it to his 50th birthday, he's a guy that if he ends up in a wheelchair, are we really going to be surprised? I mean, I don't want to see that happen, but are we really going to be surprised if Jeff Hardy ends up in a wheelchair? Not really. And it's going to be because of stupid bumps like this that he has no business taking. It's a stupid move for anybody to take. You could be a perfectly healthy 25-year-old. That was a stupid bump. To not even put your hands out to brace your fall, he had to be knocked out. He had to be knocked out on the way down. That has to be when he got knocked out. Maybe it's when he landed and hit the stairs. I'm thinking it was when he got hit in the head with the chain, because why would you not put your arms out? Why would you just fall from that height and just let your head and your shoulder take the full brunt of that blow on the steps? It doesn't make any sense. So it was very scary. Hopefully he's okay. But just to go back to the tapings themselves really quick, the crowd was not sold out. There were empty seats, but I'm guessing this was probably the most packed crowd of the three nights. It was a very healthy crowd. It was not sold out, but it was a very healthy crowd, very lively. We all got very tired by the end. It was a long taping. I really thought it would be over by 10, 10:30 at the latest. It started at, it probably got started like 7:20. But it went from like 7:20 to almost 11:30 at night. So that was a long time to be sitting there for a bunch of TNA matches. But they darkened the building again. Even though the crowd was actually a pretty decent crowd, they still darkened the building. I mean, maybe it won't be as dark as that first show, but they definitely darkened it. I don't know why they're doing that. I think it's from a production standpoint. I mean, look, I'm not a production guy, but as a fan watching, I just think it makes your product look Bush League. That may have worked 30 years ago when you had the completely dark arena, right, and all the focus is on the match. I think that that first or second match with Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, the one that went like 55 minutes, I think Steamboat won that match. I remember watching that match, and it was total darkness. Like, you didn't even know there was anybody in the building. But they did that on purpose because the focus was on the ring. To me, now, today, that doesn't work. I would much rather see a packed crowd, a lively crowd. So I don't like the darkening of the building. MVP came out, funniest moment of the entire show. If the Hardy thing was the scariest, this was the most hilarious. So MVP comes out. I said before, MVP is hated in New York City. He gets tremendous heel heat. He's out there cutting a promo. I can only imagine the edits that they're going to have to make to get this to air on Destination America. He's cutting a promo, and the crowd starts chanting MV Pussy at him. And MVP doesn't miss a beat. He's so awesome. He comes back and says, "You're right. You're right. I am what I eat." And I thought that was fantastic. But then the crowd topped themselves, and they immediately picked up on that, and the chant went from MV Pussy instead to MV Penis. And they wouldn't stop. They just kept chanting it. Of course, MVP didn't have anything to say at that point. I fucking love New York. Sometimes I hate New York, but that was one of those moments where I'm like, that was awesome. So I doubt it airs that way on television. You had to be there to see it, but it was hilarious. You know what? I'm not going to go through all the results. You can, if you want to read all of the results or all the spoilers from the shows, you can find them online. I will say this, that the lockdown taping, they did a match besides Storm and Abyss against the Hardys in a cage, Awesome Kong and Havoc. It wasn't a very good match. It wasn't a very long match. They did a lot of brawling outside the cage before they got inside. One of the funniest moments, though, was Earl Hebner was the referee for the Kong-Havoc match. So they're outside the cage, and Havoc is beating up Awesome Kong, laying her out. Earl's trying to get them back in the ring, and they're right in front of us. And he says to Havoc, "Get it in the cage, you crazy bitch." Earl Hebner just doesn't care. It's like I said earlier, when you get to a certain age, yeah, because again, Raw now has been on the air for over 20 years, and today is Raw's birthday, and you get to a certain age, you just don't give a fuck anymore. I think Earl Hebner is in that category. He told her to get it in the cage, and they did, and Kong won with a splash off the ropes. The main event, and actually, let me backtrack one more match here I just want to mention. It was Tyrus against Rockstar Spud. In a match, Rockstar Spud did a crazy dive off the top of the cage. Basically a cannonball dive off the very top. So that was one of the crazier spots of the night. And in the end, Tyrus won the match anyway. EC3 went to shave Spud's head when the match was over. Jeremy Borash was awesome during this match. He was right in front of us. And it was great because, you know, EC3 came out a couple of different times, including on the previous taping. When his music would first hit, Borash would stand up. He would kind of like back up a little bit, and you watch him, and he's just mouthing like, "Fuck this asshole, like fuck you," and he would put his middle finger up. And again, none of this will air on television, but he was selling it tremendously after what happened in the angle on TV this week, obviously, where EC3 shaved his head. So they do this match at the lockdown taping, and Tyrus wins, and now EC3 has an electric razor. He brings it into the cage, he plugs it in on the outside first, goes inside the cage, and as he's about to shave Spud's head, Borash, I don't even know where he got them from, Borash suddenly brandishes a pair of pliers, and he cuts the cord before EC3 could shave Spud's head. And Borash is just, you know, he's looking at EC3, and again, he's just mouthing off to him, and they end up chasing Borash into the crowd. It was funny. Borash was actually very good in that role. He sold it tremendously. The main event was a lethal lockdown match, which is basically like an old-school War Games match. They do the intervals. Every now and then a new guy comes in. The weapons are attached to the cage. You just got to pull them down. By this point, the crowd was kind of tired at that point. So I don't know how the reaction is going to be on TV unless they pipe in crowd noise. The crowd was okay, but it wasn't really overly loud for the match. A lot of action. It was, actually, let me bring it up. I forgot who exactly was in the match. Oh, right. It was Kurt Angle. It was Team Angle. So it was Kurt Angle, Gunner, Austin Aries, Bobby Lashley, who had said at the previous taping, "I will not be on your team," did eventually come out. He was on Team Angle. They beat Samoa Joe, Kenny King, MVP, and Low-Ki to win the lethal lockdown match. And that was the taping. I think 11:20 p.m. it finally ended. And while it was on the long side, I did have fun. So say what you want to about TNA, and we can say a lot. But I always have fun when I go to their shows. Even the old shows they would do at the baseball field in the summertime. They put on a good show for the crowd that comes out for it. TNA is not running any house shows in the foreseeable future. Dixie Carter has said that. They have no pay-per-view scheduled at this point, no house shows. That part of their business, they can't afford it. They can't afford to run house shows. So if a TV taping happens to come to your town, it's not like they're going all over the country with them. I'm hearing that they're trying to end up back in Orlando. You know, once they do these UK tapings between the New York tapings they just did and then the UK ones, they'll probably have television taped until, you know, through at least the beginning of March, maybe mid-March, so that gives them some time to try to negotiate a deal to go back to Orlando. Otherwise, I don't know. Maybe they'll just come back to New York. Can they afford to keep running New York? I don't know. These are questions that only they can answer. But for one night, it was a lot of fun, and I had a good time. So January 30th and February 6th, those are going to be the airings for the two shows. If you have Destination America, check them out. Lucha Underground was a one-match show this week, literally one match. It was their version of a Royal Rumble called Aztec Warfare, and there was no over-the-top rope elimination. It was pinfall or submission, but, you know, every few minutes a new person would come out. It was 20 men, because it was actually a combination of men, women, and midgets in this match. I was very entertained. I thought that, you know, Aztec Warfare, the concept, it came off great. It was a fun match. It was a long match, obviously. It went for the entire hour. They had as number one Phoenix, and number two was Johnny Mundo. So they opened the match, and, you know, they told a lot of little stories in there. Big Rick eventually came in, and he was kind of the odds-on favorite to win, which he did not. Sexy Star was in this match. She came out. Chavo was in there, so Sexy Star got her revenge on Chavo. Blue Demon, or as Matt Stryker likes to say, Blue Demon, made his return. We haven't seen him since Chavo put him out. So they got their revenge on Chavo in this match. It was comical seeing Masquerita Sagrada in there with Big Rick at one point. I think Big Rick actually, he laid the little guy out and pinned him. So the match ends with Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo, the two big baby faces in Lucha Underground, and probably the two best wrestlers they have, you know, Ricochet and John Morrison, going at it. There's a great finishing sequence, lots of near falls. Puma went for a Spanish fly at one point for a near fall, and Mundo hit his Starship Pain move, which probably was the best-looking Starship Pain I've seen him do. Normally, he gets maybe like 6% of the person's body he lands on. That was also good for a near fall. But in the end, Prince Puma got the win with a 630 splash off the top rope, and that means that Prince Puma is the first ever official Lucha Underground champion. This was for the brand new vacant championship belt. Puma won. They are building the promotion around him as their top babyface. He is an amazing performer. And so he is the champion. So I don't really have much more than that to say. I mean, I'm not going to go move by move, blow by blow here. I would say if you can find that match somehow, check it out. It was a lot of fun, but it was a one-match show. And then we'll see from here what the storyline progression is from here now that we officially have a champion. That was one of the things Lucha Underground was missing. There was really nothing to fight for. You know, at first they had the briefcase full of money, and then Mundo won that. And after that, it's like, all right, these guys need something to fight for. You got to have at least one belt, and now they do. And so now we'll see what direction they go in from here. But a very fun hour of wrestling. Let's move on to the mailbag here, because we're going overtime this week. I want to mention that there is a brand new Sound Off inbox that went up last week. This is not another one. It's the one that I did last week, but for those who may have missed it, it's up on our YouTube channel right now. It is well over an hour, probably close to an hour and a half, actually, of me just answering your questions that you have emailed me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. So please continue sending your questions into me. I do read everything. I'm still very much behind. I have not come even close. Every time I make a little bit of progress responding to people's questions or going through them, I get off track, and then a deluge of new emails come in. I'm just buried under an avalanche right now. But there's a lot of good stuff in there, so keep emailing me your questions. Always include your name and where you are from. This comes from Graham Matthews, and I liked it so much I wanted to share it with everybody, because I think this would have been a great idea. It's not so much a question as much as it is an idea that he pitched. He says, as you said before, the Royal Rumble pay-per-view is not about the title match. It's about the Rumble itself. So, WWE stacking the show with Lesnar vs. Cena 4 is unnecessary. I don't know how much interest it's going to garner this time around, but I still think it's a big enough match that they could have done it on the first Raw of 2015. You said yourself that it would be interesting to see Brock compete on Raw at least once before he leaves the company, assuming he does, the night after WrestleMania. Had they done Lesnar vs. Cena on Raw, they could have done some sort of number one contenders match that Randy Orton could have won after that, and we'd finally be able to get that fresh matchup at the Rumble instead, giving Lesnar someone else to beat before he drops the belt at WrestleMania. Obviously, it's too late to do any of this at this point, but I want to know what you thought. I love that idea. I mean, it's too late now, but I think that's a great idea. Would have given the first Raw of the new year a big-time main event, as opposed to another fucking Authority promo. So that would have been a good thing. You could have had John Cena get screwed out of a win by whoever his next program is going to be with, you know, heading into WrestleMania, maybe an angry Dolph Ziggler. pissed off that John Cena brought back the Authority. Maybe it is Rusev. Maybe they are going to go do Rusev and Cena, so it could have been him interfering in the match, although I'm no fan of feeding Rusev to John Cena. Maybe somebody completely different. Whoever it is, you could have done that as a finish, and then Randy Orton wins a number one contenders match, maybe some kind of multi-man match that the Authority puts him in. And then we get that Orton versus Brock match one time before Lesnar bails for UFC. I think that's a great idea. Well done. Benson from Miami, with the recent firings of Dolph Ziggler, Ryback, and Eric Rowan, how do you feel about the three superstars returning to screw with the WWE Championship match at the Royal Rumble and causing havoc as a group of renegade outsiders until Triple H is forced to bring them back so he can deal with them himself? Since Randy Orton will probably return in the Royal Rumble match itself, he probably would not interfere in the Triple Threat match to keep Rollins from winning the title, leaving the other three as the only ones left to do the job. This can potentially splinter off into a storyline where the Authority wages war against the three men, leading to matches at WrestleMania, including the one that you proposed on the Sound Off, Dolph Ziggler against Triple H. What got me thinking of this is the fact that another trio of renegades, The Shield, made their impactful debut disrupting a high-profile WWE Championship match, thus affecting the course of history in the process. Not saying that Ziggler, Ryback, and Rowan are Shield 2.0, however, the scenario could be part of a very interesting road to WrestleMania. Not a terrible idea. I could even see that. I expect all three of them to be back at the Rumble, probably in the Rumble match itself. This firing stipulation is not going to go on for very long because they need those guys back. That's why the whole thing was stupid to begin with, or part of the reason it was stupid. Look, if it leads to Ziggler and Triple H, I thought they could have gone in that direction without fucking firing the guy in storyline. You didn't have to do that. But if it leads to Triple H and Ziggler, it would make sense. I have no reason to believe that they're doing anything other than Sting and Triple H. I think that's still the end game here. Where they'll leave Ziggler, I have no idea. You could have the Authority kind of put Ryback and Rusev together, you know, with like Rusev being a hired gun. But again, they already started in that direction. You already had a feud that you were building with Ryback and Rusev, and it's almost like now that's on the back burner. You don't need the Authority to be involved to progress to that match. And then Eric Rowan, look, I don't see Eric Rowan on that level. I just don't. And nor do I have any interest in seeing Eric Rowan, you know, come back as some renegade outsider. I just don't think he's the right guy for the role. I mean, frankly, I think somebody from the New Day, had they not done this stupid New Day gimmick, or if they did it the right way, then, you know, they'd have something already for themselves. They have nothing. I think a guy like a Kofi or a Big E would be much more productive in that role than Eric Rowan would be. I don't really see him as some great renegade outsider. Maybe they will. Maybe their involvement in the Rumble will involve them interfering in that match. I don't think so, but it's possible. My whole thing is this. You didn't have to do the whole firing gimmick, which is so tired, and nobody buys into it. You didn't have to do that to get to that point, is my point. But they did, and it's such a tired thing, and not the way that the new year should have started, I think, with the same tired old gimmick. I mean, that's really, above all else, what bothered me about what we saw at the end of Raw Monday night. Ace from Michigan. When I look at Kofi Kingston's career, he reminds me a lot of Jeff Hardy, without the drugs, from 2001 to 2002. Hardy carried like 10 different titles and had consistently great matches without ever really having a great long-term feud. Speaking of Hardy, after the ridiculous bump he took at the TNA tapings, what are some of the craziest non-Mick Foley bumps and dives that you have ever seen? My personal list would include Jeff Hardy's Swanton off the Titantron onto Randy Orton in 2008, and Rikishi at Fully Loaded 2000. I'm telling you, man, that Rikishi bump off the cage does not get enough love. The sight of that guy standing on top of the cage and inching his way to the middle without holding on to anything, no bar to grip, no safety net of any kind, and then doing that splash onto Val Venus. I just think that whole thing is underrated as all hell. You know, for all the highlights we always see, and you very rarely, if ever, hear about it or see it. And I don't know why. I mean, I know they're not, you know, in the company anymore, but so what? That was a hell of a spot. My heart, when I watched that back, like I watched it on YouTube not too long ago, my heart still pounds when I watch it back, but I'm also afraid of heights, so that probably has something to do with it. The craziest non-Foley bumps or dives, pretty much anything involving Shane McMahon, I would say. The dude had a death wish. The bump he took off the SummerSlam set in 2000 in that match with Steve Blackman was out of this world stupid. It was every bit of a 50-foot drop. So many things can go wrong with a professional stuntman doing something like that, let alone somebody who is not a professional stuntman. I miss Shane. So yeah, pretty much anything involving Shane. To go back to the first part of your question, though, the Kofi-Jeff Hardy comparison, if we're just talking 2001 to 2002, then yeah, I mean, they're probably very similar. When Hardy came back, though, when Jeff came back to the company, he had some great feuds with Umaga, with Edge. I'm probably leaving somebody else out. I wouldn't call the Orton feud a great feud, but maybe you could throw that in there, too. So he had those feuds, then he won the world title. I never saw Kofi as having that same level of popularity, except, you know, maybe that one night in the Garden when he did the boom drop on Orton, but that was one night. That was one crowd. They never really gave him the chance after that, so who knows? Who knows how big he could have gotten? But I never saw Kofi having the same connection to the crowd that Jeff Hardy had and still has. The Hardy thing was, you know, it was organic. He would lose a lot, just like Kofi would lose a lot. But he doesn't have, Kofi, that same natural support that Jeff Hardy had, even when he was booked like a mid-card guy. He still got main event reactions, even though he was a mid-card guy. In 2008, Jeff Hardy was the most popular guy in the company for a while. He was the most popular guy. Kofi has never been anywhere close to that level, and he never will be. And it struck me with Hardy, I didn't make this comment when I did the TNA review, but when I, you know, see Hardy come out at the TNA tapings, and I even had, you know, this young kid next to me who was a huge Jeff Hardy fan, it really hits you, no matter how many years that guy has been floundering in that company, Jeff Hardy is still a very big star, and he's got a lot of younger fans out there, and I don't doubt that if he came back tomorrow to WWE, he would still get those main event level superstar reactions from the kids, from the women, and even some of the guys. I don't know if he'd be positioned that way right away, but Jeff Hardy is still a big deal. Jeff Hardy, not for nothing. I mean, I think the bumps and everything are just incredibly stupid. And I'm sure he enjoys doing the tag team thing with Matt right now, but Jeff Hardy should be slotted a lot higher than he is in that company for the support and the level of fan response that he still gets. He really should be higher up on the card than he is. Mario, longtime listener from California. I was listening to the episode of Jericho's podcast where he interviewed Hulk Hogan. In part two, they discussed Hulk's heel turn in WCW when Hulk stated that he originally wanted to turn in the months following his loss to the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 6, but Vince McMahon would not allow it. Given some of the things Hogan has claimed over the years, auditioning for Metallica comes to mind, I question this claim, but for the sake of argument, let's say that it's true. Would a Hogan heel run in early 90s WWE have worked? That's a great question. I would say yes, but not after WrestleMania 6. I think, first of all, I don't even know that that's true. I always heard Hogan say that he knew Warrior was a flash in the pan and it wasn't going to work out. If he knew it wasn't going to work out and that Vince would end up putting the title right back on him, then why would he want to go heel right after WrestleMania 6? That didn't really make a lot of sense to me, him saying that. But I do think that Hogan by 92, maybe 90, maybe late 91, but definitely by early 92, there was definitely Hogan fatigue in WWE, and probably a lot earlier than that, but I think it went more a little more mainstream by early 92 in terms of some of the reactions he was getting. I mean, when he got dumped out of that Royal Rumble, I mean, the people cheered. You know what I mean? And that wasn't the only time that Hogan was getting bad reactions. You know, I'm sure back at some of the house shows and the live events I remember reading, there were plenty of people booing Hogan at that point. That probably would have been the time to do it. Instead of Hogan just leaving the company for a year and then ultimately leaving for good, you know, Vince probably should have at least thought about turning Hogan in 92 and taking some of that discontent that people had with him. But here's the problem with that. You could turn Hogan, okay, and maybe it works. Maybe Hogan gets over as the nastiest villain that WWE has ever seen. He stabbed the fans in the back. Maybe it would have worked. It would not have worked as well as it did in WCW because it was a different time. It was an older audience. You wouldn't have F fans back in 1992 had Hogan turn heel, for example, throwing garbage and debris at the ring. You're just not going to have that. The audience was different. The audience was a lot younger, I think. It was families. It was more family entertainment. So the Hogan heel turn in WCW was probably a lot better than it would have been, I think, in WWE at that time. But the other consideration that you have to make here is, okay, you turn Hogan heel, right? Well, who's the top babyface then? You got to have some babyfaces that are strong enough for Hogan to feud with. You had the Macho Man, who they put the belt on at WrestleMania 8, and he was still a big name. Could you have built around Savage as the top babyface? I guess you could have. I'm sure that's what they would have done. But you got to have more than just Savage, though. And Bret Hart, you know, it wasn't until the end of 92 they put the belt on Bret more as like a desperation move to get away from, you know, the steroid bodies and everything else. So Bret really wasn't being pushed at that level at that point. Maybe they could have rushed it and pushed him a lot quicker. So maybe Bret. So beyond Bret and Savage, I mean, who else was there? Piper, after WrestleMania 8, I think pretty much went away after he dropped the belt to Bret. So I don't know that Piper would have been around. You really have to have strong baby faces. I don't know that they had enough strong baby faces at that time. Now, Warrior did come back. So let's assume that Hogan just doesn't go away. Instead, he turns heel. Now they got Warrior back. Okay, now you got Warrior, you got Savage, maybe you got Bret as the new kind of younger guy. That, I think, would have given you a good nucleus of guys that Hogan could have feuded with for the next year. So, yeah, I think it could have worked, but I just don't think it would have been quite the same as it was in WCW with that audience, as rabidly anti-Hogan as they were and throwing trash and stuff. It would have been different. I'm not saying it wouldn't have worked. I just think it would have been different. I just think 1990, it was still too early. Hogan was still the biggest babyface they had. The Warrior thing didn't work out the way they wanted to. Hogan, they kind of fell back on him. Had they turned Hogan heel and Warrior didn't work out, they had no big baby face to fall back on, they would have been in a real tough spot. You have to take stock of who your other baby faces are before you take your biggest one and turn him. And you can even compare that to John Cena now. If they turn John Cena heel tomorrow, you look at the baby face side, who do they have? I guess Randy Orton, when he comes back, will probably be a baby face. They got Daniel Bryan back. They're giving the big push to Roman Reigns. They've got Dean Ambrose if they haven't killed him yet. So they have some guys. They could turn Cena heel tomorrow, and they've got some big... And Brian may be the biggest of the bunch, just because I'm guessing he probably sells a lot of merchandise. Not as much as Cena, but of that group, probably sells more than any of them. And I think he's the closest thing to being the guy since John Cena became the guy. I really felt like in some ways that SummerSlam match a few years ago could have been a passing of the torch, and it wasn't. It's kind of the same thing. Turn the guy. If you've got other guys that you can rely on, in 1990, I just don't think that would have been right. 2 years later, yeah, I think that would have been the time to do it. Javon Main Event Mallet from Toledo, Ohio. My little 5-year-old cousin has been a wrestling fan for 2 years now, but he wants to see how wrestling was when I grew up. I grew up in the Attitude Era. He's already seen The Godfather. He's seen the Val Venus choppy choppy angle. And This Is Your Life. He's so entertained with it and wants to see more. What Attitude Era content should I show him? 5 years old, huh? 5 years old. I wouldn't show him any of it. I think it was funny, even in the Attitude Era, when they would ask like Vince and Linda McMahon about that, I think they even said, like, if we had a child of even like 8 or 9 years old, we wouldn't even let them watch the product. So I'd probably be leery showing a 5-year-old kid most of that stuff from the Attitude Era. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, look, if I think about it, a lot of the stuff with Austin was a lot of fun. Whenever he would drive the beer truck out, the monster truck, the Zamboni. I think the whole Austin versus McMahon feud was very entertaining. I mean, the Austin character, if you're bothered by having a guy go out there and constantly flip people off and use the word ass, you know, if you're fine with the 5-year-old watching that, then I would just go with any of the Austin McMahon stuff. I think would be that might be some of the tamer stuff they've done. DX I'd probably stay away from. But yeah, probably a good idea to just keep a 5-year-old away from the Attitude Era entirely. Just a thought. Ron from Harrisburg, we'll end with this. When and how did you find out pro wrestling was a work? Also, if you had any child fans in your life, how and when would you tell them? I think I've told the story before. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I knew when I was a lot younger. I kind of knew. I don't remember what age. I think it was like a gradual thing. But the story that I remember was back in 92. I was in school. We were at recess. There was a payphone in the building on the first floor. And at recess, all of the kids, well, not all of them, but like four or five of them in the class, piled into this phone booth. And I couldn't imagine what they were doing. Like, who are they calling? So I'm kind of in the back. I'm not actually in the phone booth, but I'm standing there trying to eavesdrop and listen to what's going on. And they were on the, they never spoke to anybody. They made a phone call. The call ended. And one of the kids, name was Keith, I remember, he said, oh, Ric Flair is going to win the Royal Rumble. And I'm like, how do they know? Of course, it was one of the early wrestling hotlines. I don't know what hotline it was. They obviously called a hotline. Somebody knew. And they heard that Ric Flair was going to win the Royal Rumble. And sure as shit, Ric Flair won the Royal Rumble. And I looked like a genius when I watched that show at my grandparents' house. And we're sitting there, and they're like, who do you think's going to win? And I'm like, Ric Flair. And they're like, what? You're crazy. And sure enough, Ric Flair won, and I looked like the smartest person in the room, and I was the youngest kid. So by then, I definitely knew. But I'm positive I knew well before that. As far as, like, if I had a kid or, like, a nephew or somebody young, you know, how and when would I tell them? I honestly, I wouldn't want to say anything to them, at least not at first. I would kind of want them to figure it out on their own. I mean, there were other things that I saw, too, even before in 92, the way guys would throw certain punches that didn't connect, and miraculously the other guy would sell for it. You just kind of figure it out over time, the more of that sort of thing that you see. And then maybe one day if there was like a major injury angle, somebody got hurt, and I saw that they were really disturbed by it, maybe then I would kind of tell them, well, he's not really hurt. That might be the time that I say something. Like, no, he's not hurt. He's only pretending to be hurt. But, like, nobody ever did that with me when I was a kid. I kind of figured it out on my own. And when I think back to my childhood memories of wrestling, I'll give you an example. 1987. May have been late 86, but it's probably early 87 at this point. The injury angle that they did with Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat when he had the ring bell and drove it across Steamboat's throat. And I think actually before that, Steamboat maybe did like a dive to the outside and landed throat first on the guardrail. And then I think Savage maybe hit him with the ring bell in the throat. That to me as a kid was the most traumatic thing in the world because this guy is gasping for air. He can't breathe. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, holy shit, this guy can't breathe. Like he's going to die. And it was such a simple angle. And they put him on the stretcher. He's like wailing around, grabbing his throat. He can't breathe. He's trying to breathe and he can't. That was traumatic to me as a kid. Okay, but I feel like I wouldn't have wanted somebody to say to me at that point, oh, it's not real, don't worry, he's just faking it, because to me it would have ruined the whole thing, you know? I feel like there's got to be a period of time that goes by as a kid where you just either let them figure it out on their own, let them be traumatized by a major injury angle, you know? I wouldn't have wanted somebody to tell me that that wasn't real at that time. I still think back to that angle and I'm like, man, that, you know, it was such a simple angle, but like I remember vividly at that time being really bothered and really disturbed by what this man had done to Ricky Steamboat. And then Steamboat came back for his revenge, and you know, it's such a simple story. So I would be hesitant to say anything, I think. You reach a certain age, and I guess if they still haven't figured it out, then you just kind of say to them, listen, hey, it's, you know, it's entertainment. And then, oh, what do you mean by that? And then you got to explain it, and I just think you're robbing the kid of his childhood if you tell them too early, you know, and I don't know what that age is. It all depends on when you become a fan. Some kids don't become fans until they're 8 or 9. Some kids are fans like I was. I started watching it, you know, sitting in front of the TV when I was 4 and 5 years old. You know, no wonder I was traumatized by the whole Steamboat Savage thing with the ring bell. Maybe it would have been different had I not gotten into wrestling until much later on. So I would be hesitant to say anything right away. There does come a point where you got to say something if they haven't figured it out on their own. I think most smart kids, though, will figure it out on their own. So that's probably how I would handle it. I kind of miss those days, actually, where I did think that all of that stuff was real. I almost feel like if I came up as a wrestling fan now, some of the stuff they do, it would be almost impossible to just buy into any of this stuff. And I know there are kids who do, but it boggles my mind, some of the ridiculous shit that they do now. And how you do an injury angle. like a modern day version of the Steamboat Savage thing, you could say, would be like the Bray Wyatt Dean Ambrose angle from SmackDown all those weeks ago when supposedly Ambrose got a crushed trachea, couldn't breathe, grabbing his throat, put him on a stretcher and take him out. Oh my God, what happened to Dean Ambrose? And then fucking 4 days later, he's back on TV like nothing ever happened. You know, it's like, I feel bad for kids who don't know how it used to be, who could actually buy into something like that and think it was real and be concerned for the wrestler. When they're back 4 days later on television like nothing ever happened, who cares? Who could possibly care? Finally here, we haven't done sad tweet in a while. This week's sad tweet, it's actually sad and hilarious all at the same time, comes from an exchange on Twitter that happened last week with, of all people, Billy Gunn and the Young Bucks. Billy Gunn sent a tweet to Nick and Matt Jackson that said, "I have an idea. Leave the suck it to the professionals." I guess somebody said something to him, or maybe he saw a clip of the Young Bucks, maybe from the New Japan show, and how they do a lot of the old like NWO, DX mannerisms, too sweet, suck it. I mean, that's the whole shtick of the Bullet Club and the Young Bucks. Like, they're clearly ripping off those other factions, and they don't hide it. They're not hiding it at all. It's almost like a, I don't want to call it a parody, but, you know, kind of, in a way, that's what it's like. So Billy Gunn must have found out about this and sent them that tweet. And so in response, this is awesome. In response, the Young Bucks said, "We're doing your guys' full entrance on the next pay-per-view." So, a nice little fuck you there to Billy Gunn. Although, hey, they're going to pay respects to DX and the New Age Outlaws. It's out of respect, I'm sure. So Billy Gunn just made the situation worse for himself. I don't know why a guy who works for WWE the way he does, he's a trainer down in developmental, why would you even want to get in a pissing contest with two guys that aren't even in the company? That could only get you into trouble. Just keep your mouth shut. So, yes. Billy Gunn kind of making an ass out of himself on Twitter, which is appropriate because he used to call himself Mr. Ass. And so now the Young Bucks will be doing a New Age Outlaws entrance, I guess, on the next pay-per-view. Hopefully I'll have a chance to see that. You can vote for us in the Wrestling Radio Awards. Now, I asked you guys a few weeks ago to do this for me. They were in the nomination period, and now I guess this is like a new nomination phase. I have no idea what happened. I don't know if all of your nominations ended up meaning nothing at all, but now we're in the official nomination period. It ends next Sunday, so we have 1 week. You can vote every day, once a day. Go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com. I believe it's on line 2 of the ballot. You'll see a graphic for Show of the Year for that category. You could type in Solomonster Sounds Off, the full name of the podcast. If you will vote for us and nominate us, that would be awesome. So WrestlingRadioAwards.com. Again, you can vote once daily, so spread the word. Keep sending in your emails and your tweets. At Solomonster is my handle on Twitter. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is my profile page. We have a fan page that you can like. If you want entry into our private discussion group on Facebook, you will first need to like the fan page. And once I see that you've done that, I will approve you for acceptance into the group. We are on YouTube as well, YouTube.com/TheSolomonster. I have a lot of Sound Off extras up there, including my Sound Off Retro video, the interview I did with the late Tim Arson a few years ago, which is a really good interview, a lot of fun. And again, it's a shame what happened to him, but take a few minutes and check out that interview. I think you guys will like it. Maybe some of you heard it but haven't heard it for a few years. I hadn't listened to the interview back probably in a good 3 or 4 years. So I listened to the whole thing back the other day, and I really enjoyed it, and I think you will too. So check that out, you know, give it a thumbs up, leave some comments, show us some love, and subscribe. Hit the subscribe button on the YouTube channel while you're there. Thank you for your continued support via PayPal donations on thesolomonster.com, using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Buy a shirt in our store, prowrestlingtees.com. You guys are awesome. You've been doing all those things, and I can't thank you enough for that. We will be back next weekend for a brand new episode of the Solomonster Sounds Off. That'll be episode 364, hopefully with less news to talk about so we can, you know, spread things out a little bit more. We had a lot to cover this week. I didn't know how I was going to pull it off, but we did. I was able to do it in less than 2.5 hours, too. Very impressed. So we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you right back here again next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Salamonster sounds off.
They give us the dreaded fuck finish. Lame, lame, lame. You want to do the finish where the guy gets DQ'd for kicking ass? How about not doing it with your Intercontinental Champion? How about that? Some of these matches will go 10, 12, 15 minutes only to get a fuck finish or no finish at all in the end. If WWE insists on fucking the fans over so many times, the least they can do is buy us dinner first.
Salamonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Salamonster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Salamonster sound off.